Hello, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Silmarillion Film Podcast. I am your co-host, Dave Kale, coming to you live, as always, from Pasadena, California. And I am joined, unsurprisingly, by the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson. Sadly, Trish is not joining us right away because she has some personal business to take care of this morning, but she assures us she'll be joining us a little later. Isn't that right, Corey?
That's what she says. We'll see. I hope she'll be able to make it later. We'll see what's able to happen, and we'll.
I hope so, because this is a big episode.
This is. We're talking about the season finale of season three. We are coming to the end of our third season. Kind of amazing to think that we've completed almost three seasons here. Though, of course, when I say the season finale, I mean it's the finale of we are planning the episode that will be the finale of this season. It is, of course, not the end of our film. Season, as we still have a bunch of other things to discuss after we finish planning out the episodes. But we are planning the final episode today, and that is always a big deal. So, and of course, we get the rising of the sun. We finally, after many years, get the full outdoor color palette, so that will be pretty exciting. Okay, so to start with a few announcements, and I've got some really exciting announcements, some of which you have heard me say before, but the biggest thing, it's been 3 weeks since we've had film, and an enormous amount has happened in that time that we've been away. Most notably, Signum University has officially begun our review process for state certification in the state of New Hampshire. I did a big announcement session on that last Thursday night, so just a week ago yesterday. And it is an enormously exciting time for us. We are it's this moment where Signum University is finally, you know, transitioning from this startup thing, which is built on a really good and exciting idea, to becoming a fully established university, a fully established institution of higher education, which will be, you know, legal in all ways, and rubbing shoulders with you know, all the other mainstream universities. The image of myself sitting with the other presidents of the other universities, you know, me sitting there with the president of Southern New Hampshire University and the University of New Hampshire, and you know, all these other schools. You know, on the Commission for Higher Education in the state of New Hampshire is kind of amazing after sort of where we've come from. But that's where we'll be. That's where we'll be in a couple months if things go all according to plan. The main thing I was sort of asking for on Thursday night, you know, that led up to, is a lot of people were asking what they could do to help, and of course the main thing we needed help with was financial resources. It's an expensive process, and certainly more money than we had sitting around in our pockets. The total cost of the certification process was almost $24,000, and so again, I announced that last Thursday night. 6 days later, we had raised $27,000. We've received over $27,000 in donations in a week after we made that initial announcement. It's just absolutely the enthusiasm and generosity that everybody has shown has been absolutely amazing, and I am just enormously grateful and excited to have all of your support and to see your enthusiasm in this. The good news is that if we reached our goal too quickly and you didn't get a chance to donate and were hoping to, don't worry. There's still a chance to do so. Because, of course, after we finish the certification process, we will then be beginning the process of applying for accreditation. And the great news is that accreditation is even more expensive than state certification. It's either a little bit more expensive or a lot more expensive, depending on the outcome of some preliminary conversations that I plan to have with the accrediting people. So if I pass my charisma check, it'll only be a little bit more expensive than the certification process. If I don't, it'll be substantially more. In any case, so everything that we raise in our credentialing fund, everything that we have raised above what we require for state certification will be going to accreditation. And it's awesome, actually. We've already raised enough for – there's like a sort of a preliminary readiness screening test that we have to do, you know, just to do a quick review to make sure – so that they can make sure that we, you know, we have all the basic boxes checked so they know we can really begin the accreditation review. And we've already raised enough money to cover that. So we already have enough for like the very first step of the accrediting process, and so that's really exciting. So just to make sure everybody knows about this, so this is I'm going to do some navigating here. This is the Signum University homepage, of course, and if you go. One thing, just to see if you want to, if this is the first time you're hearing about this and you want to learn more about this, I recommend our blog post here on our website. This will give you all the information that you need to explain what's going on. It has a link to the donation page and also, of course, an embed of the recording of my session on Thursday night. If you want to hear me explain the whole process in more detail. You can also reach this same page through our donate tab over here to our credentialing fees page. And you can see our updated text here announcing that we completed it raised everything that we needed and explaining about the sort of the next part of the road here. And this, of course, is our donation form for the Signum Credentials Fund there. So anyway, thank you guys so much again for your generosity. And if you haven't gotten a chance to give and would like to help to support us continue to work through the certification and accreditation process, then, you know, we really encourage your support. You know, Dave, I was talking actually with the Commissioner of Higher Education in the state of New Hampshire on Tuesday night or Wednesday night. I can't remember which one it was. It was Tuesday. And, you know, we were reflecting on the fact that both of us think that Signum University might be the first crowdfunded university ever.
Huh.
I mean, I'm trying to think, has anyone ever crowdfunded a university before? I mean, people raise money, right? I mean, that's a normal thing. But usually raising money means like going out and finding a very wealthy person to give an endowment, right? And which, by the way, I have no bias against very wealthy people who want to endow Signum University. I want to make that perfectly clear. That's perfectly welcome. But what we have done so
far. They're welcome to join the crowd.
You're absolutely welcome to join the crowd. No criticisms for, you know, being a little late to the party. It's great. But nevertheless, this has been super exciting, you know, that we're able to, with, you know, it's the one thing that I've been saying, you know, in our application for certification is that, you know, Signum University started with no resources, right? We started with no endowment. We started with no institutional connection. We have had one thing all along. There is one thing that we've had, and that's people. You know, people and people's support, and it's been pretty fun, Marie. You know, it's funny because the Higher Education Commissioner was teasing me about exactly that. Marie was just saying I won't be naming any buildings after the rich people, and that's exactly Mr. Seidel, the Commissioner, was teasing me and saying, "Oh well, yeah, you've got a big problem that you can't name any buildings after people." And so I was saying, we've been trying to think of creative ways around that. You know, my own personal suggestion is that we name tabs on our website after major donors, right? This would be like, you know, the admissions tab made possible by, you know, or you know, it'd be like the Daisy Smith Memorial Admissions tab on our website. You know, I don't know. It is
kind
of challenging.
They can have a podcast episode dedicated to them.
Yeah, you know, we'll see. It is possible, Marielle, it is possible that we could name, like, departments or things like that, or chairs. Yeah, endowed chairs are awesome. I would love endowed chairs. That would be really cool. And frankly, I would like endowed chairs for, like, staff too. You know, this is a thing. Like, it's traditional to have like faculty, you know, endowed faculty chairs. I think it would be really great just to have, I mean, endowing our people. That's what needs endowment, right? We don't need buildings.
Yeah.
You know, give us money to help us pay our people, and so have and so to have you know, kind of named seats for that. You know, to put your name to, you know, like the chair of, you know, for like, you know, for I don't know, for me, like for the president or for some other position, you know, with like for a dean or for you know, our bursar or whatever. It would be cool. Well, David, see,
I do agree that that's going to be the you know, like that's the selling point, which I don't know. I kind of think with all the press around ballooning higher education costs and stuff, I would think there have to be progressive minded people out there that would be excited about the idea that they could donate money and have it go toward paying, you know, teaching salaries instead a building with a plaque.
Instead of buildings. Exactly. I mean, that's exactly it. The Signum budget. I mean, as I've been mapping forward, you know, part of this process, I've been mapping forward, you know, 6-year budget projections, which are always fun. It's like, you know, kind of writing, it's like writing fantasy, right? But anyway, budget projections are always an entertaining exercise. But as I'm doing it, you know, what I'm seeing, you know, consistently, our budget is projected to be 85 to 90% salary. Like that's our cost. Our cost are our people, right? Every, you know, almost everything, you know, everything that isn't invested in like fee, you know, government fees or bank fees or software licenses, essentially, and, you know, library resources. There are a few like small places that we have, but I mean, as we're going to be moving forward, 90% of our, you know, annual budget will be for people, for salaries. And yeah, I think that's a pretty exciting selling point, frankly. But yeah, so we'll see. So we'll see. As I say, to, you know, for people with resources who might be interested in helping to endow Signum University, again, don't get me wrong, you are absolutely welcome, and you know, we will celebrate you very wonderfully. We just don't have buildings to name after you, so there we are. So, okay. So anyway, so that's our that's the like big news going on at Signum, and it's one of the reasons why I've been more scatterbrained than usual, which is one reason why it's also another reason why episodes have been posted less frequently recently, just because we're all preparing for our state review, which is a big deal. So, but anyway, first and foremost, thank you everybody who has helped to contribute to that. And again, if you want, there's still lots of room in that boat. You know, as I say, I posted a full, you know, breakdown and chart of our certification expenses. My goal is total transparency through this entire process. However, I can't yet be transparent about the accreditation fees because, as I say, I'm still kind of trying to negotiate exactly what that's going to be. So, but I will certainly have some updates about that before too long. The plan, by the way, of course, needless to say, I cannot guarantee when we would receive accreditation or even indeed if we will receive accreditation. We are applying for accreditation. We will be reviewed and we will hope for the best as a result of that. But I do hope to be beginning that process within the next few months. We certainly, by the fall, we should be well invested in that process. So I will keep everybody updated as we move along. But anyway, so that's the big Signum news that's been going on lately. And again, thanks to everybody who has helped to make that possible. So that's announcement number one today. We also have some other awesome things going on. London Moot is coming up quickly. If you are anywhere around in Europe, anywhere within reach of the UK, I encourage you, there's still time to register. Come to London Moot April 28th. I am very excited. I've been, you know, looking at the calendar and I'm getting ready to fly over to London. I haven't been over there in years now, and I'm really excited to get back. And to be able to meet up with a bunch of you guys. So don't forget about that. Londonmoot.com is where you can go to find the registration links and stuff.
So Londonmoot.com?
Londonmoot.com, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, good.
Yeah. Also, the registration for summer courses at Signum University is open. So for those of you who either have been auditing classes in the past, or if you've ever been thinking about our program, of course, with our news of our big transitions here and our making everything formal and taking the next step forward as an institution, now's a great time to join our program. If you've been waiting for that, either our certificate program or our master's degree program, definitely encourage you to look into that. Never been a better time to start your Tolkien Studies certificate program or your master's degree with a specialty in imaginative literature or Germanic philology. Should be great fun. So, again, so the summer courses begin on May 7th, so there's still time to get in from scratch if you want to apply now. We received several applications here in this last week, so still time to process those and get started and join us. And of course, Mythmoot 5, Fantastic Frontiers. It is definitely time to register for Mythmoot. Still a couple months on that, June 21st, but Mythmoot is gonna be great this year.
When are you going to announce the program, make decisions about abstracts, etc.?
That is coming very soon. So if we go, let's go back to the Signum homepage, and then you see we're scrolling down here. Here's all the events that are coming up, including, by the way, this is a recent one. Tom Shippey doing a little symposium on his new book, Laughing I Shall Die, Lives and Deaths of the Great Vikings. Tom Shippey on Vikings and sort of the Viking mentality is going to be really, really cool. But anyway, Mythmoot is what we're talking about. So here's our Mythmoot page. The program should be announced soon. I know they're finalizing that now. We've been working on a bunch of things with that. Our events team is working really hard to get things set. So they're finishing that. That should be coming out very soon.
Good, because we're waiting with bated breath.
I know. Yeah. I haven't heard an exact date on that, but I haven't heard an update on that actually in a little bit, as I've been buried in other things while I've
been a little distracted.
And also, of course, trusting Mythmoot planning to the very competent hands of the events team folks who have been doing such a great job with it the last few years. So anyway, yeah, that will be coming very soon.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, anyway, just definitely want to commend that to you guys. And those are our announcements for this time. Sorry, it took a little while for the announcements, but it's a really big announcements going on at Signum this time, the whole life of Signum University. Looking forward to the end of the Silm Film Season 3 process here. We are moving after today into our post-season sessions. Our next two or three sessions will focus on the script outline review. Maria, that's adorable that you think we could possibly talk about all the script outlines in two sessions. I am touched by your faith. I think that's exceptionally unlikely. I would say 3 to 4, or maybe 3 to 5 sessions is a little bit more realistic. We'll be beginning that soon. And of course, the costume sets, props, character design, music content, still lots of opportunity there for. We're starting with the script outline because those have been in process for a while, and we want to give people as much time to think through, the people who are creative minds who are at work on things like costume sets, props, character. Those are things we want to give folks time to do. And the timeline for casting will be announced once the script outlines are reviewed and the character list is finalized. So let me walk you guys through this a little bit, because I wanted to do this Rather than just posting a link, which especially if you're like watching this on YouTube or something, that link isn't going to help you. So just let me make sure everybody knows how to get there. So up at the top of the Signum homepage or the Mythgard homepage is a link to the forums. So you just click on the forums, and there's Silm Film right up here at the top, right? So these are all the Silm Film forums, so you can see if you're interested in contributing to any of those other, you know, if you've got ideas about costumes or some designs that you've done or music or the sets and props, casting, all that stuff is all here, right? And you can go and you can contribute to that. If you want to look at the scripts, so for next time, we're going to be looking at the script. So you go to the script one and then season three. And then this is the script outline, the set of links to the script outlines, which are Google Docs, which you can access. So these are the first four here. And then they carry on there a little bit. There's just through the first six here. Certainly as much as we will get to for next time, I am certain. So, yeah, so there you are. So just to make sure everybody knows how to get here, these discussion forums are really the heart of the Silm Film project here. The opportunities for you guys all to get together and suggest it. I love the whole, our goal with Silm Film from the beginning, you know, was not just to have a podcast where we are kind of holding forth on what we think this should look like, but for this really to be an active creative collaboration among us all. And certainly, I don't have any talent in, you know, costume design or being able to write musical themes. So I always really look forward to seeing the work that everybody else has done here. So anyway, so just wanted to show you where to find that stuff so you guys could all know how to do that. Okay, so that's the plan. So let's move forward now.
Sure,
go ahead.
Corey, not to delay us anymore, did you want to address the elephant in the room, the announcement about Fall of Gondolin?
Oh, the Fall of Gondolin, yeah. Sure, we can talk about the Fall of Gondolin. Fall of Gondolin should be fun. I mean, it was more fun than it was to participate in. By the way, small Fall of Gondolin story. So I've been listening to the Silmarillion in the car with my kids while I'm driving them to school lately, and we're up to Of Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin now, and I was so proud. Like, when we just this morning got to the moment where Turgon decides not to follow Olmo's directive to leave Gondolin, and my son's face palmed when Turgon decides not to do it, and I'm like, yes, I was so proud. that as soon as he rejects the Council of the Ward of Waters, my sons are like, oh man, that's gonna turn out well, they said. anyway, so it's gonna be fun.
You're raising them right.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, but as for the book to be published, The Fall of Gondolin, my understanding here is that The Fall of Gondolin is going to be a lot like the Beren and Lúthien volume. That is to say, containing, I believe, as far as I understand, no new material, that is, only material that's already been published in the history of Middle-earth. The main function of the volume, again, like Beren and Lúthien, and to an extent, though to a lesser extent, than The Children of Húrin back in 2007 or something. That was ages ago now. But anyway, the point of those is to bring it all together into one place, right? So if you want to read the full story of the Fall of Gondolin, to read all the different, you know, the different versions of it that Tolkien wrote over time, you don't have to go hunting through the history of Middle-earth for everything. It just presents the whole thing with pretty illustrations by Alan Lee. So, I'm sure it will be a gorgeous book. Those books have all been gorgeous and worth having for that alone. I'm excited about it in one sense, but my excitement is kind of tempered by I kind of got my hopes up a little bit with the Beren and Lúthien book that I have to admit was a little disappointed. That is, what I was disappointed by was that there was no new material at all. And the thing is that based on what Christopher says in his commentaries, especially in The Lost Road, volume 5 of the History of Middle-earth, he suggested that there was more material out there, that like Tolkien had written stuff and then condensed it down, but the longer thing that he wrote didn't, you know, Christopher didn't include it in The Lost Road. So, you know, but I get it. Like, I get why he didn't do that. You know, he didn't want to make this the, like, ultimate, you know, hodgepodge of everything Tolkien ever wrote about Beren and Lúthien. He wanted to present the story, you know, more or less as it had been, as it had been presented. But again, just to put it all in one place for, you know, for readers who, you know, so he was not catering to the folks who had already read carefully through the history of Middle Earth. He was catering to the folks who didn't know it at all, who, for whatever reason, didn't read the History of Middle Earth series. And so I get that. And I think that that's a really great idea. I mean, I think it's really cool to have people, you know, I know that that a lot of people who got Beren and Lúthien were reading the Book of Lost Tales version of the Tale of Tenuvial for the first time. And that's great. I mean, awesome. Wonderful that people, you know, get the chance to be presented with Tevildo the cat and everybody else, you know, where they might not have seen it and might never have found it. And so, with the Fall of Gondolin, it's going to be the same. Of course, the centerpiece has got to be the Book of Lost Tales version. The version of the Fall of Gondolin in Book of Lost Tales Volume 2 is not only the longest version of the Fall of Gondolin he ever wrote, and one of the very first things, really, the first Middle-earth thing he ever wrote, but it's also the only one he ever finished, ever. So, he wrote a kind of a summary, which he sort of finished later on, which a lot of the you know, in the 1930 quinta, but or 33 quinta, but it's
how would you say this would align to the version in Unfinished Tales?
Oh, that'll be included too, but it won't align to that. See, so the version in Unfinished Tales is the version that Tolkien sat down and started writing later, like in 1951,
right,
after he'd written
end,
The Lord of the Rings. Yeah. And it's much, much longer. I mean, had he finished that, that would have been novel length by itself, it seems pretty clearly. I mean, it's already a pretty big chunk of Unfinished Tales, and it's only, like, it only gets to the point where Tuor doesn't even get to Gondolin. Right, I mean, he just gets to the gates, and the gates open, and he's looking out over the valley and sees Gondolin in the distance, and that's it. So, I mean, that would have been hundreds of pages long had he finished it, but he never did. If I had even the remotest, you know, if there were any possibility that Christopher had stumbled upon the secret finished version of that version of the story, like, man, this would be the most excited book. I would be waiting. I'd be lining up in the street on release.
That's
day.
What I'm wondering. Like, what are the chances of that?
I think zero.
About zero.
Yeah, about zero. They really are.
Because
I'm pretty sure that he just
never
wrote it.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it really would. It really would. It's been a while now that has been at the very top of my list of things I really wish Tolkien, of all of the things that Tolkien left unfinished, that's the number one I wish that he had finished, is the 1951 Tuor story. The Fall of Gondolin is going to be great, but again, if you know the story, I mean, like, if you've been going through the history of Middle Earth, you know, with me in the Mythgard Academy series we've been doing on this, if you've been following along with the Mythgard Academy series, you've pretty much, you will have read everything that is going to be in that book already. Essentially, I mean, it's going to be the bit from the Book of Lost Tales, Volume 2. It's going to be the stuff from The Shaping of Middle-earth and The Lost Road. It's going to be the bit from Unfinished Tales. And that's going to be pretty much it. A little bit of commentary, probably. But there won't be any other material. So it's great. Wonderful to have it. It's worth it as packaging. You know, and that sounds insulting, but because, again, I know that not everybody reads the History of Middle-earth series, right? So I think it's great to have a mainstream publication to really spotlight, you know, the Beren and Lúthien story, and to spotlight the Fall of Gondolin. Very cool. The Children of Húrin, of course, was a little bit of a bigger project in the sense that although all of that material had been published at one time or other, it had never anywhere been put all into one continuous story. When he published pretty much all the material in The Children of Húrin was derived from the Unfinished Tales bit. But in the Unfinished Tales bit, he didn't do that. You know, he just, if you remember in Unfinished Tales, there are long sections of that where he's like, and from here on, it's pretty much follows the published Silmarillion until we get to this other set, and then here's a new chunk of text. So there was nowhere on Earth where you could just sort of read through the entirety of the uninterrupted Túrin story, you know, the longest version of the Túrin story. And so The Children of Húrin was in that sense presenting us with something new, something that we hadn't seen. It wasn't, no bit of text I think was brand new then, but at least it was presented in a totally new way, and for the first time you could just read it uninterruptedly all the way through, and I thought that was really great. So this should probably won't even be quite that, but I mean, hey, anytime there is a new Tolkien publication, it is still exciting, and I'm glad they're doing it. So, thank you for reminding me to say something about that, Dave. I'd almost forgotten.
I think there would have been a riot if you hadn't addressed it.
Yeah, true. Okay. All right. Well,
now to the business at hand.
Let us talk about this episode. So, let's look at some of these elements. I have to admit, I'm a little concerned about where we're going to... I mean, I've been expressing this concern for weeks that... well, not concern exactly. I don't know what it is, but reflection that we are coming... You know, about how the ending of Season 3 does not have the kind of climactic ending that the rest of the season, the other two seasons have had. You know, there is no cataclysmic event which is concluding this the season. So the sort of mapping out the momentum of this episode, I think, is going to be really important to kind of make this the biggest challenge, I think, of episode 13 here is making this feel like the end of a season, you know, making this feel like a season finale, and not just, and now we're going to stop talking about this, which I think there's a real chance that it could feel that way if we're not careful. Yeah, see, Marielle, it's tough because on the one hand, it's not that I don't think the rising of the sun is. I mean, that is it's not a cataclysmic event, right? But it is an epoch-defining event. I mean, the rising of the sun is a really big deal. But it's kind of a gentle big deal, right? Compared to the darkening of Valinor, right? On the one hand, I love the correspondence of that, right? You know, how we end season 2 with the darkening of Valinor and we end season 3 with the rising of the sun. The kind of symmetry of that is beautiful. Again, like on paper, I think it's great. When I actually think about what it would look like on screen and how we shape this episode, it's a little bit less clear to me. And I think you'll see what I'm talking about as we go through. Let me just say at the very beginning, before we start talking about the individual elements, because it's going to come up as we go through some of these elements, my real question is, where do we end? So Mariel, just thinking about what you were just saying, right? If the rising of the sun is truly the culmination, right? If that is the exciting moment that we're building to at the very end of this, you know, of this episode, how do we have that? Do we have it at the end? Right? Do we want the sun to be rising in the last, you know, 5-10 minutes of the episode to have the closing sequence of this episode, the closing sequence of season 3, be the rising of the sun and the various reactions to the rising of the sun? Or do we have it happen earlier on in the episode? And if so, then what happens? So again, we'll see as we're talking about the different elements what I mean by that. But I think it's going to be a factor with a bunch of these different parts.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what we said about this a few weeks ago, about sort of we had some ideas about maybe showing the rising of the sun with the Morgoth's creatures and in full flight and
yes.
Things like that.
Yes, with reaction shots and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, we'll see. We'll kind of let's talk about the different elements here. The first thing we know is the captivity of Mithros, right? Because we had Mithros be taken captive by Sauron and the trolls without the assistance of Balrogs last time. So we have he's been captured. I certainly agree. We don't need to torture him on screen, and I don't think an interrogation scene is what we want. There's no information that we need to convey to the audience there, right? The concept questioning by Morgoth will reveal that the Noldor rebelled against the Valar, right? He doesn't know what they're doing here, whether they've been sent or are they the advanced force of the Valar coming to trample on him? That has to be his number one fear, you know, his number one concern. So he will figure out, either because he will be told directly by Mithros or because he will conclude, based on what Mithros tells him, that the Noldor have come on their own. That they are not supported. In fact, not only are they not the vanguard of the force of the West, but they have come in defiance of the Valar, which I have to think that Morgoth is going to find exceptionally encouraging. So I think that Morgoth has got to be fairly pleased about what he learns from Mithros. Now, it's a great question that Marie asks here. The death of Feanor, will that remain unknown? I don't know. I don't feel really strongly about this. On the one hand, he's got to learn about it sooner or later, right? And if he's got to learn about it, why not sooner, right? If he doesn't find out about it until season 4, for instance, by that time, I mean, a lot of water will have gone under our bridge by then, right? And it seems like if season 3 really is Feanor is kind of the dominant figure in season 3 here, I would think that at least, you know, Morgoth's acknowledgement of, or his learning of his the death of Feanor might be a good thing, actually, to happen here, so that we can kind of close the book on Feanor here. And then when we start season 4, we're just completely in a post-Feanor world, and there's no, you know, not, I mean, people will allude to him, obviously, and the oath is going to stick around, but to have him not be, I think having, you know, even a brief subplot in which, you know, Morgoth still has not yet learned that Feanor is dead, that would seem to be a distraction at the beginning of season 4, I think. So I think we might as well have him discover that here.
I like the idea of closing the book on Feanor at this point.
Yeah.
I think
that's
a good way to go.
I think so. Mariella's a great suggestion that we could have Morgoth's horror at the rising of the sun, right? His horror and terror when the sun rises would be well balanced, or would come in very appropriately if we have him very, you know, gloating, right? He's gloating about the fact that the Valar aren't coming. He can be telling himself and boasting to his servants that that even the Valar don't dare now to come against him. And then Feanor is dead, and he'll be boasting and mocking Feanor and his brief rebellion and his pitiful attempt at vengeance. And how far away he, you know, how close he didn't get to recovering the Silmarils or anything. And so then for him to be caught in the midst of his triumph and gloating by the rising of the sun, that seems to work really well, actually. So, yeah, that's good. Yeah, Phil suggests that Morgoth could be taunting Mithros, saying that you know, that even his dad won't be able to save him or something like that, and then Morgoth can just kind of read in Mithros' reaction the truth of Feanor's death. That I think that something like that would, seems to me like that would work really well.
Yeah, I like that. That would be very dramatic.
Yeah, that would be cool. Okay, so afterwards, okay, so we've got so Morgoth is going to, of course, send the second embassy to the rest of the Sons of Feanor. And I would think during that embassy, they would reveal that they know that Feanor is dead, right? Because remember, Sauron, when he came and was treating with Mithros, didn't know yet. But anyway, okay, right. So the terms, of course, if you don't remember this passage in the text, they send the sons saying, "We'll release Mithros if you go back into the west, or like retreat down into the south of Middle Earth, far away." Basically, leave. You know, get out. Give up your war against me and go far, far away. I don't care what direction it is you go, as long as it's far away. Anyway, so that's the second embassy. They reject it. The rest of the other six sons of Fëanor, excuse me, five, we're down to five, six in the book, five for us. The five remaining sons of Fëanor reject the terms because they know that Morgoth is going to keep faith, even if they, you know, no matter what they do. And anyway, they can't because of the oath. So how do we want to do this second embassy? I don't think we need to make a huge fanfare of it. I mean, like, we made a really big deal of the proposal of the meeting and then the meeting. And, you know, I don't think we need to go through that same sequence. I think we should have a herald come to the camp, perhaps. You know, so have somebody show up at the gates of their encampment, which they've fortified now, and just, you know, sort of deliver this kind of Mouth of Sauron-esque, right, to say that we have this prisoner. In fact, exactly Mouth of Sauron-esque, right? Yeah. In fact, exactly. Let's have him show tokens, right? Tokens of the, you know, have them show something to prove that it's really Mithros, that they do in fact have Mithros, and that's yeah, Marie, I was thinking of a lock of his hair too, which is of course very distinctive, Mithros' hair being very distinctive, but yeah, something he was bidden to show to them. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think that Oakwig, yeah, Oakwig says, so Sauron should be the Mouth of Sauron here. I like it. That would be hilarious, actually. Yeah. We could do a direct parallel, Tony. Tony is suggesting, like, the Mouth of Sauron could be a turned dark elf, like the Mouth of Sauron was a turned mortal. We could do it that way. I kind of like the idea of having, like, the Mouth of Sauron later on be sort of recapitulating the role that Sauron himself played in that earlier scene. That to me really seems to fit the overall pattern that we see so often in Tolkien. I've talked about this before, how it's like a figurative, it's the way that you get that echo, right, where it's lesser as we move forward, you know, the echoes get smaller as we move forward. Yeah, having it be Sauron, therefore, would kind of make sense and be cool, I think. The reduction in scale. So let's say it's Sauron. So say Sauron comes to the gates and offers the terms, and they reject the terms. Same thing, right? He shows the tokens, he offers the unreasonable terms, and they reject utterly the unreasonable terms. Oh, that's great. I had not even thought of that parallel until just now, and I love it. I think that's absolutely fantastic. Okay, so we can do that in one shot. Again, we don't have to set up a whole parley and everything. We just have him come as a herald and be rejected. And now I agree, Marielle, that what we should be emphasizing is not callous abandonment, right? It's not like they don't care about Mithros, even though some of them are kind of scheming against him, but rather it should be their skepticism, right? Their sort of pessimism, assuming like Mithros is lost. They could either assume that he's dead or that he Morgoth's just going to kill him anyway. Oh, Oakwig, you are right. We should actually have Sauron. Wouldn't it be cool if Sauron actually said, like, "I am the Mouth of Morgoth," right? Come on, that would be fun. But anyway, yeah. So no, the other sons of Fëanor would be assuming that Morgoth isn't going to keep his word, and yeah, there's every reason to think they're completely right about that. Nick, you're right. Nick points out that Sauron should blame the capture on Maedhros, saying that he violated the terms of their parley. You know, that that they have taken captive this base and faithless traitor who who sought, you know, in this cowardly and blackguardly fashion to ambush their emissaries. That would be cool. David, absolutely, he would call him Melkor the Great. He would not call himself the Mouth of Morgoth. He'd call himself the Mouth of Melkor, of course. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, Tony was just saying the same thing, too. That's what I meant. That's what I meant. Yeah, very good. good. So I think that's all fairly straightforward. After they reject these terms, Maedhros then gets stapled to the cliff face. He's gonna have a view of the arrival of Fingolfin later on, but we'll get to that in a minute, or a few minutes. And yes, we certainly do need to see Maedhros hanging there in the sunlight. I am thinking that, you know, the end of the season needs to be like a sort of, you know, pastiche of different images that we're getting juxtaposed against each other. And certainly, Maedhros hanging in misery in the sunlight, right as the sun rises, is certainly got to be one of them. Yeah, good. Okay, Mariel in particular wants to see the scene in which he actually gets stapled to the cliff.
That's pretty bloodthirsty.
It is. But I like that. I mean, I generally agree that I don't think we need just extraneous torture scenes. You know, I don't think we need to just go out of our way to show him on the rack or something like that. But emphasizing both the cruelty of Morgoth and also the suffering of Maedhros seems to be a good thing, I think. We definitely want to show that.
I do wonder how do the mechanics of the cliff stapling actually work?
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, do we have him actually?
Yeah. They have a harness,
like a scaffold, right? Yeah,
yeah.
Is Morgoth in one of those like cherry picker buckets? You know, that comes up from the that's a really good question. This is another of those moments.
The stunts people would and set piece people would love it if we say like, oh, we'd like to film this scene.
Yes.
And in fact, you have to construct the whole scene, figure out how to do it, and then we're going to show 5 seconds.
right. This is actually one of those scenes which it comes across really powerfully in the prose. But yeah, when you actually think about seeing people stand, like, what's Morgoth standing on? When he is, you know, when they're attaching Morgoth to the cliff, how does that work? I don't think it can be lowered from above. He can't be just chained, because it's not the same thing, right? If he's on a chain, if his wrist is chained and the chain is hanging like from a staple, so that Maedhros is kind of swinging free, that would certainly be painful enough to him, but it leaves him, it'd be too easy for him to escape. There's a reason his wrist is stapled directly to the cliff instead of being attached on a chain. If he's free like that, he can relieve his suffering, right? I mean, if you're just hanging from your chain on a rip, he could pull himself up and, you know, prop his feet against the cliff and, you know, haul on the cliff with his left arm, and, you know, in other words, there's lots of ways in which he could relieve the you don't just get the unrelieved suffering of hanging there by your wrist. So chaining someone like that, and then of course there's more chance of him to actually try to get free of the chain, and it would seem easier for Fingon to be able to get through of the chain. So I don't think he can possibly be on a chain. It's too easy. It's too easy. I think that he has to, I think he's got to be stapled. And I think that we can, especially if we make the band that attaches him to the wall thick, you know, like not just like one bar around his wrist, but a thick thing like the size of a bracer on his forearm, then he won't be able to move, right? So I think that that's important. Okay. Let's see. Okay. I think having there be a ledge right above him makes, I think, the most sense. That seems to me to work. He wouldn't be able to reach it. That way Morgoth can stand with a certain degree of dignity, right above him. He would be able to be attached that way, right? We could have orc slaves or whoever is doing the actual nail. Presumably Morgoth is not himself wielding the hammer or whatever the tool is that attaches him to the cliff himself, right?
Staple gun.
The staple gun, exactly. Yes. Yes. The evil staple gun. So
and actually if the ledge is like properly formed, like if it juts out far enough, it actually forms a barrier, making it harder for Mithros to escape.
Exactly. So they'd have to take him to this ledge with the cliff face below it, possibly, as you say, like a little bit undercut from the ledge, right? Then all they'd have to do is that one of the orcs would have to like toss him off, holding his hand, right? So his hand would be held. He'd be hanging from his hand by one orc, and then the other orc would just have to drive the band in around his wrist as it's there. So his hand could be like as it's hanging. His hand could only be like a foot below the edge of the. I mean, he wouldn't be able to do anything. He wouldn't be able to reach it. It could be a little bit further down than that. But that seems to me like that would work. Tony, yeah, I love that. Tony is suggesting that we should use this as a foreshadowing of what will happen to Húrin, that this could actually even be the same place where Húrin and Morgoth have this conversation later on. Yeah, I like the idea that ledge should be big enough that Morgoth comes with a chair next time and puts Húrin on that ledge, on that same ledge. I kind of like that. Cool. Nick, if we wanna, you know, toss an orc off or something, we can totally do that. You know, that's no problem. To sort of show how high up the cliff is and everything, you know, we can certainly have one of the orcs do. I'm almost Karita's suggesting that that Morgoth sort of melts the rock face and just binds his arm to the rock itself. I kind of like that. I'm tempted to do a cliffhanger thing, right? Like, wouldn't it be kind of funny if he was going to get tossed over, and he caught himself, and he's hanging from the ledge in like a classic Hollywood cliffhanger moment, right? He's hanging by one, and then he's just grabbed, he's just stapled to the ledge there. It's like, okay, there, I'm just going to leave you right there. Yeah.
So you mean they don't.
Oops, sorry, I lost you there, Dave.
That out to staple him to the.
Oh, sorry, you're breaking up a bit. I didn't hear the last bit.
I said, so they don't set out to staple him to the cliff. They try to throw him over cliff.
They try to throw him over, himself. And he catches. Yeah, and he like throws off one of the orcs and catches himself. And Morgoth's like, okay, fine, we'll just do this. No, we can't really do that because Morgoth would. The plan would have to be to have him be tortured and not just executed. So
right.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
Also, I don't think we want to turn this into an action scene.
What? Oh, come on now. We don't want to add unnecessary action scenes? I thought this was supposed to be a, you know, oh, okay.
A blockbuster.
This was supposed to be a screen adaptation.
Yeah, good.
Isn't that what you
do? Good point.
Yeah. Oh, well. anyway, okay. So they go up there, and Mithros might be under the impression that he's going to get thrown off the cliff, right? So, you know, we could sort of have him struggling. But yeah, I don't know if I mean, the idea of the Iron Band is kind of, symbolically, I like that, you know, with the sort of the connection to Angband and the, you know, it'd be kind of fun if it were sort of similar to the Iron Crown, like if it looked kind of similar. I'm not crown shaped, you know, but like there was this, when you go back and forth between Mithros and his Iron Band and Morgoth wearing his Iron Crown, right, to be able to sort of see the similarities between those two, I think is, would be kind of cool. That's good. Yeah, and I agree, Nick, he does have to be far enough down that he can't pull himself up and grab the ledge with his left hand. Yes, though even there, what's he going to do? You know, I mean, he can't go anywhere. And he could only reach the ledge by kind of contorting his right arm and then grabbing, what, up like this. And then what? Like, now what do you do? So I'm not even sure that... That's gonna matter too much, but yeah, I think the ledge above his head is the perfect solution because it gives Morgoth a first, you know, then we don't have to have Morgoth rappelling down the cliff face or hovering in midair implausibly or building a scaffold of some kind or anything kind of disappointing like that. Oh, Marielle, you are on fire today. You are completely right. We need a reason for Curufin to forge Angrist, the knife that cuts through iron. Except he can't forge it in advance, of course, because then Fingon could have... Well, of course, but Fingon wouldn't have it. But yeah, maybe that's what inspires the forging of Angrist is the story afterwards. So yeah, having the iron there... that way we can have Curufin allude to the binding of Mithros' wrist when he produces the knife, right? Yeah. Oh, that was Maria's suggestion a long time ago? Cool. Oh, right, of course, Telkar makes the knife, right? But that's why Curufin carries it. Yeah, no, that's good. I like it. Okay. Good, so... Excellent. I feel good about this. And we need a taunting speech, right? We need a taunting speech from Morgoth. And here again is where I want to come back to the point that Tony was making, which I think is excellent. We want to establish that this should look and sound familiar, right? This should look and sound familiar when Húrin is up there again, right? When Morgoth is up, possibly on this very same ledge. With Húrin later on, and Morgoth is boasting, the sort of the boast and the taunting should be sort of similar. Now, not exactly the same, because I want Húrin's defiance of Morgoth to be a remarkable thing, right? I don't want Maedhros to be defying Morgoth in the same way or to the same extent. Maedhros is awesome, but Húrin, the defiance of Húrin the Steadfast has to be a thing which genuinely takes Melkor aback, right? So I don't want to echo it too much in the dialogue there. But yeah, I definitely think that, you know, Morgoth's attitude should be sort of similar. Yeah, because Mariel, he's going to be giving Maedhros a view, right? Hang there and watch as I destroy the rest of your kin should be more or less the message, right? Cool. Tony suggesting that maybe he can sort of mock Maedhros or sort of remind Maedhros of the way in which he manipulated the Noldor into rebelling in the first place, right? So that this is the, I can imagine him saying something like, you know, behold the fulfillment of all of my designs for the destruction of your kin, that were conceived back in Valinor and, you know, when I began deluding you completely, you know, you morons over there. Yeah, exactly, Mariel. I don't think they have a conversation. I think I think this is a monologue, almost entirely a monologue. I would be okay with having Maedhros be barely conscious, essentially, during this whole thing. So, yeah. I think that all works really, really well. Okay, good, excellent. Well, let's move on to the next element then. Fëanorian politics. Now here, I get, I start having trouble. Okay, first part is fine. Maglor, a weak leader, is ostensibly in charge. Yeah, this is tough because Maglor is next in line, and certainly is the one that Maedhros would have trusted most. But of course, Curufin is indeed calling the shots. Amros hates everyone is in despair at the loss of Maedhros. Hey, I have an idea. What if Amros dies here? What do you say? Should we just kill off Amros? I don't know. And this might be a good opportunity.
we're really working at this, aren't you?
I just don't want to let an episode go by without suggesting the death of Amros. But no, it's fine. No, we of course Amros will survive. But I love Amros hates everyone is a good. See, I wanted to put him out of his misery, people, but you insisted, so that's fine. Amros hates everybody, and you know I'm just teasing everybody, right? I mean, this is a running joke now, people. I want to make sure you're taking this in the right spirit. Okay, so I agree we have this complicated situation where Curufin is basically in charge, but he's not taking command, at least not yet. He's the one who decides to refuse Morgoth's terms, yes, because they're so obviously false. He may suspect that Maedhros is already dead. I got to assume that they're going to assume that he's already dead, right? They believe the tokens that he's taken, but they assume that he's dead. Also, the oath prevents them meeting the terms. Yeah, there's really no way that they can. And maybe, I'm thinking maybe Maglor points that out. That is, the other, you know, Curufin and Carinthir and Celegorm can all be saying, we will never do that, and Curufin saying, you know, we will never leave, we will never give up, and Curufin saying, you know, there's no point in doing it anyway because, you know, he's almost certainly lying and Maedhros is probably already dead. And Maglor, I think, could be the one to add, and even if we did want to, we can't. You know, we are trapped in this, whether we want it or not. That is the sense in which the sense of the Oath of Fëanor, which they have sworn as a, you know, a noose into which they have placed their own heads, and a restraint to their future deeds. That's got to be something that is already, it's not yet wearing heavily on Maglor, but he is conscious of it. And he has this foreboding of how this oath is going to be dominating the rest of their lives. Whereas, again, I think that Curufin and Caranthir and Celegorm are not going to be bothered by that. They're still kind of gung-ho. And Emros, of course, is certainly in agreement about how he in fact could say some very negative things about how, you know, they're all trapped and screwed. I gotta think Magor's position here is pretty bad. I mean, pretty unhappy. You know, with the prospect of Mithras's death in particular. Now, this is where it gets tricky. Fingolfin's arrival.
Why is this tricky?
Okay, this is tricky because Fingolfin does not arrive in Mithrim, according to the text. Like, as he arrives in Mithrim, the sun rises.
Mm-hmm.
So, Fingolfin and his host arrive. The sons of Feanor and their smaller host says, "Oh, shoot, Fingolfin is still alive, and they're here, and they're probably a little ticked off about the whole burning of the ships thing. Let's prudently move to the other side of the lake so that we, you know, give them some space," right? That all happens after the rising of the sun. So where do we have that happen in this episode? Is that what we end with? Tension around Lake Mithrim? That seems to me about the least exciting ending of this episode that I can think of. You know, Fingolfin triumphantly arrives in Middle-earth. Great scene. The sun rising. Great scene. Fingolfin pounding on the doors of Angband. Awesome. The sun shining on Mithras hanging on the cliff face. Great, great material. The moving of a camp to a different place and the vague, unverbalized tensions between two armies. Not a really climactic moment.
That sounds like compelling TV.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a good setup for future action, right? But not, I can't see a way to make that exciting, to make that element of it exciting. Just like that, to end with, you know, political tension. And then political tension breaks out. Like, that's, I can't get behind that as the culmination, you know, of the whole season, essentially. I think that the, especially since we're not gonna do anything with it yet, right? The fact that people be able to figure out on their own, right? That now that the people of Fingolfin are there and the people of Feanor are there, and the, you know, we know how ticked off many of the people of Feanor are, especially Angrod and maybe Turgon, are about this, that there's likely to be trouble, right? The idea that that there's tension in the air and that there's stuff that's going to need to be worked out or else this could get ugly. They're not going to need to have two armies actually sitting there in different camps kind of glowering at each other across the lake, right, in order for us to establish that fact. The mere moving of camps, I think, not an exciting element for this scene. Therefore, what I would suggest is that we save that. I think it would be best if the Feanorians and the people of Fingolfin don't interact at all. Maybe the Feanorians don't even know that Fingolfin is back. I don't care if they don't know. Maybe they hear about it. Maybe they hear a rumor. I don't know. But I don't particularly care. We know, right? And our viewers will know that they're back and that potential trouble is brewing. And if that is something that makes them interested to see how this gets resolved and what happens in season four, great. But I don't think this is the culminating spot that we're trying to build everyone to, right? So we'll come back. Obviously, we'll be considering Fingolfin and Fingolfin's movements and how those work in the timing of this scene. I don't think we get the moving of the camps. I think the moving of the camp happens in episode one of season four.
Yeah, that'll work better at the beginning of a season as a setup for future drama.
Yeah, exactly. It's a setup for future drama. It's not. It is.
If you're looking for ways to make this less even more anticlimactic, then definitely finish.
Right. Finish with a relocation of camps and a wordless standoff. That's not.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
It doesn't scream drama to me. Again, we're going to get back to. This and you know, Kurita, I agree with you. Kurita makes a great point. And you know, Kurita, I'd never made that connection before, but you're completely right. Oh my goodness, how did I never make that connection? Kurita is saying that the meeting between the Feanorians and the followers of Fingolfin is like the meeting in Genesis between Jacob and Esau afterwards, right? When Jacob is returning and is worried about how, like, you know, Esau is going to come and it's the moment where Jacob is like, I'm going to put my least favorite wife and sons in the front, right? Just in case he sets upon us. But anyway, it absolutely does have the flavor of that meeting. And I think that's, and of course, because it's, Kurita, as you say that, I'm shocked that I've never thought of that before, because of course I've often thought about how, you know, the kinslaying is, you know, we get all this, like the Aule and Yavanna chapter is, you know, we get this recapitulation of the sacrifice of Isaac, right, from Abraham. We get the recapitulation of Cain and Abel, right, in the kinslaying. Jacob and Esau thing, that I agree. That's really, really cool. That works super well. I think we save that. I think we do the Jacob and Esau thing in episode one of season four. I don't think we do that here. We'll save that. We'll save that part. Okay. Yeah. It's funny, you know, I've been talking about this very much, but almost every time I allude to season four, almost every time I have alluded to season four throughout the entirety of season three, I'm getting these running comments. There's been this, like, whispering campaign from the script writers in the comments about how we need to expand season four, and we're going to need, the dark implication that we're never going to be able to get through, that we need two whole seasons for Of Beleriand and its Realms, that we can't possibly accomplish that in one season. We'll see. I've been not talking about it because it's not relevant yet. That's a discussion for another day when we're planning out season four. But I just wanted to acknowledge that this has been a continual running theme. But we'll see. We'll see. We'll see. No problem. Willing to consider it, but just not right now. Okay. So... Right, so we'll do that. We'll do that in episode. And I brought this up because Marie was just saying, like, okay, we could do that, but we're going to need more episodes in season four. I get it.
Good.
Okay. Okay. It's fine. Okay. So this means that the last thing then we get from the Feanorians, potentially, like the last dialogue that we get from them, could be this conversation where they're talking about the oath and how they are bound to maintain their war against Morgoth no matter what, right? Some of them saying that with enthusiasm, like Caranthir and Celegorm in particular, I would think, and some saying it with, you know, and one, Maglor, saying it with resignation, and one, Amros, saying it with despair, right? So, yeah, I think that seems like a good place to leave the Feanorians, actually, at the end of season three. Yeah, cool. All right. Yeah, what they hear or don't hear about Fingolfin's arrival, let's worry about that later. Okay. On to the host of Fingolfin. Okay, so Fingolfin wants to find Feanor and Morgoth, and he sensibly prioritizes Morgoth. I do think that there should be some Angrod in particular. We mentioned as the chief when they were setting off across the Helcaraxa, we made Angrod the chief spokesperson of the let's kill Feanor camp. So yeah, I think that makes sense. And that when they arrive, therefore, he should also be the voice of the people who are like, okay, Morgoth's a lower priority. Let's go get Fëanor, right? You know, like as soon as they arrive, especially after all the suffering in the Helcaraxa, there's a subset of the followers of Fingolfin who are just their number one goal is to get back at Fëanor. So they want to go find Fëanor first. So I would think that Fingolfin would have to overrule Engrod in particular, and say, no, we're going straight to Angband. We're going against Morgoth. And they blow their trumpets, and the sun rises. Again, the timing... So now, the timing of the rising of the sun... in the text, as I said, the sun rises as they arrive in Mithrim. I think the sun should rise when they arrive at Angband, is what kind of makes the most sense, I think, with a visual adaptation. Because what we're wanting to show is the effect on the enemy. I think it would be pretty cool if Fingolfin is driving straight towards Angband, anticipating resistance, right? Anticipating... I'm not saying that it rises at the last second, but I'm saying as they're coming in, they should be in view of it. Like, it should be off in the distance. And they should be trying to decide, do we attack now? Do we try to regroup and recover a little bit more first? And then the sun rises. Yeah, Nick was thinking a similar thing. Nick says, the most dramatic thing would be for Fingolfin's host to be arrayed against everything Morgoth can throw at them, and then the sun rises and scatters Morgoth's forces. I was thinking about something like that, basically, where they see Angband, right, and they're deciding, like, should we attack? And I don't know, like, it looks pretty, you know, the darkness is very strong, right? The shadow is almost impenetrable. How can we hope to fight against that? And then the sun rises, right? And Fingolfin sounds the trumpets and says, let's go. Is Turgon in the let's go kill Fëanor camp? Turgon was the spokesperson for... He was the prophetic one, right? He was the one with the foresight saying that it's important that it is important for them to go to Middle-earth, right? So that he was just of the... This is our job, right? We should go because it is important that we do so. That was, of course, before his wife died in the crossing of the Helcaraxa. So, I don't want to make Turgon just go bloodthirsty, though. Turgon shouldn't be bloodthirsty. He is too, I don't know, judicious a person, I think, to just go bloodthirsty. Besides which, we already have bloodthirsty. Like, Angrod is the voice of bloodthirsty, right? We can have others kind of joining him, but I don't like doing that with Turgon. Here's the reason. The main reason is that when Turgon makes his bad call at the end... I want that to be like the first one, basically. I want that to be seen and felt by the viewers to be out of character for Turgon. That is the fall of Turgon right there, when he decides to reject the counsel of the Lord of Waters. I don't want to see him falling here. Exactly. We got to keep him noble.
I agree with that. I think we can, you know, that fall of Turgon can be really, really dramatic if we sort of keep alive the viewer's hope that he really is, that he's the kind of the salvation. Like, exactly. I think you want the naive viewer, the person who hasn't read the books or isn't familiar with the story. I think you want them watching this thinking, wow, everything's going to hell. But Turgon will like pull it out in the end.
He is the hope, absolutely. Including Morgoth, let's remember. Everyone, including Morgoth, thinks that Turgon is a legitimate threat. Turgon could be the one. There can even be some kind of, I think there should be, because there is in the text, this almost, like, not quite messianic, but those kinds of prophetic rumors, you know, that Turgon could take down Melkor. Turgon could be the key to ending this war. And he has to act worthy of that. This is what that stuff is there in the text. Those predictions are there in the text, even that kind of messianic flavor. Now, it's about Eärendil that the text gets more explicitly messianic, right? But even with Turgon earlier on, we do get some of those elements, especially going back to the earlier texts. So good. Yeah. And Nick, I think it's a really good construction. He's anti-Feanor, but not pro-kinslaying. In fact, Nick, he could even make a speech, right? He could even respond to Angrod by saying, you know, I have no more love for the Feanorians than you do, Angrod. But let's not become like them, right? Let us not recapitulate in ourselves, you know, the crimes that they have committed that will certainly solve nothing. Okay, cool. So good. They don't know Feanor's dead yet, right? True. The reforging of Ringo, I love this element, right? I love that, I love the reforging of Ringle as a symbol at the end of this. That should definitely come near the very end of the season. Absolutely. I don't want to do the two camps. I don't want to do the tension between them. But I think that we can do the reforging of Ringle, certainly. Brianna is suggesting that maybe Turgon could be the one who is prophesied to bring balance to the Force, which I think is a very attractive idea. It's like that. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of how they talk. Not in those terms exactly, but just as, you know, just as Anakin Skywalker is viewed as, like, kind of vaguely, right, this one who is, like, destined to do great things and bring about a really good end, right, even though it's all always kind of vague what that end is going to be and in what sense the Force is imbalanced and how it's to be brought back into balance and what that even means. Nevertheless, it's, yeah, that with the more concrete goal of the overthrow of Morgoth, that sense is something that should be the arrival of Turgon. This is why the arrival of Turgon at the Nir-Nyth Arnoriad is like a eucatastrophe, right? And why it's, because it, Fingon's rejoicing in the arrival of Turgon on the field of the Nir-Nyth Arnoriad is not just because he's like, hey, unexpected reinforcements. This is great from a tactical standpoint, right? It's not just that, right? Turgon is there. It's not just that there are 10,000 elves there. Turgon is there, right? Turgon has come and now is going to be, they were hoping that this was going to be, they'd already been doing their the day has come thing, right? The night is passing. And then when they say that, and then Turgon shows up. Right? Look at that. See, the night is passing. The day has come. Turgon is here. The time of the foretold overthrowing of Morgoth is at hand. Right? That should totally be the spirit of the beginning of the Nir-Nyth Arnoriad. So we do need to build that up, right? To have that sense of Turgon being the one who is going to, and I think we can begin, I think we begin sowing the seeds for that here in season three. We begin first with his sort of prophecy of what, you know, like that they need to be here. And if they come to Middle Earth, right, then, you know, if they cross the Helcaraxa and come to Middle Earth, then Morgoth will be overthrown. right? You know, that kind of thing, right? And he's the one to utter that prophecy originally, and then they come back and anyway, so yeah, I think that it's all good. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so we'll come back to the timing of the forging of Ringo, because again, I want to bring that into the larger discussion of how the sequence of events works and how we build to the end of this episode. Okay, so let's keep going. We'll come back to Ringo. All right, other key things happening in the episode. We got the rising of the sun, of course. Kieran's messenger arrives in Menegroth to report on the burned Teleri ships. Yes. Didn't we have the messenger of Kieran and Celeborn leaving after they spotted the Feanorians? No. We didn't, did we? No. We had Kieran sending the messenger after they found the Teleri ships, but before they found the Noldor. Yeah, that's what we did last time. Okay, right. So that's kind of a downer for Thingol and Melian at the end of the season. So I have good news and bad news, right? The good news is always back. The bad news is, but he's probably dead. We don't really know. All of his ships are burned. It looks bad. Yeah. So what's the gist of that? Where are we leaving this? By this, I should be more specific. Where are we leaving the Menegroth story? Where are we leaving the Doriath element? Because this is the sign-off, essentially, unless we want to include them in our montage of images at the end, which I think we probably should. But where do we leave... where do we leave Thingol and Melian? I was suggesting last time, I think, that Melian is going to have some kind of sort of foreboding of what is going to come. And she doesn't have foresight or anything, but she, you know, gives a sort of a general warning. Yeah, I agree, Marie. I was remembering that, too, that originally we were going to end the Doriath scene with Thingol and Melian discovering that the Noldor had arrived, right, and not knowing what that meant. Or what the significance of that was. But they're not going to even learn that, right? They're just going to learn about the burning of the ships. So what conclusions do they draw from that? Where does Melian go with that? What do you think, Dave? How cryptic should she get here? She could certainly have some kind of general insight, right? General insight into
I don't think she should. Yeah. I don't think we want to get like a detailed accounting of their deeds up until this point. But she should definitely be the wet blanket on any enthusiasm about like, oh, look, more elves. That can only be good. Help from the west.
Help from the west. Except it's obviously not going well because their ships are already burned.
Yeah,
because I mean,
I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what the delivery should be, but she should definitely say, you know, she should be tempering any enthusiasm thing going
on. Right, but there wouldn't be too much enthusiasm, would there? Because the news, in as much as they have news, it's bad news, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah.
It almost makes me think that
she doesn't afford her much opportunity to be a wet blanket.
Right. It almost makes me think she should be giving a word of hope when they're sort of despairing.
Yeah, well, what if we have her? What if we have her give sort of the first of many, you know, prophecies about how hope will come out of the arrival of the Noldor or something like that? You know, allusions to future events.
Right, but of course they don't even know anything about the Noldor.
But, or around, well, yeah, you're right.
That's the problem. I'm sort of realizing that we've by the course of events as we've unfolded them, we are sharply limiting the information that Thingol and Melian have to this point. Celeborn's going to come back in season 4 telling them about he's going to meet with the Noldor, and he's going to tell them what's going on around Lake Mithrim. But that's next season. So, okay, I guess here's the way I'm thinking it through. I'm thinking we need two steps, right? First, we need, like, what is a logical conclusion to draw from this based on the evidence, right? So they hear an account. Oh, and by the way, I love the idea that it's Enile who comes with the tidings. For those of you who don't remember, and if I'm remembering correctly, and Marie, you can tell me if I am, that's the guy who takes in... who is Tuor's foster father. If you remember when Tuor flees from the Easterlings and he's fostered in the wilderness by one of the Grey Elves, that's the guy, right? Am I? Yeah, right. That is the guy. Okay, I thought so. So that's cool. We get to introduce another named character who won't come in and be relevant for like another 7 seasons. But that's great. I actually like that. Okay, so... So yeah, it seems to me that we should have somebody responding to, like, based on what we've heard, this is the logical conclusion. Like, this is the thing that we should conclude is probably happening as a consequence of that. And then she should respond to that with some kind of insight or foresight about, you know, hinting at what actually is happening because the conclusion that they come to is wrong. But I can't decide what the original conclusion is going to be. So, I mean, okay, I'm like... I'm Thingol, right? Here I am. We've just fought off the enemy, and it didn't go totally according to plan, and we had that spider business, which was totally unexpected. But, you know, the girdle is up, and that's kind of good now, so Doriath seems to be safe, so I'm now feeling confident, though sort of besieged. And the Thallus is still destroyed, and that's bad. But anyway, we're safe now, we think. We're pretty sure we're safe now. And we defeated the orcs and they've run away and we chased off the spiders, or at least the missus chased off the spiders, so that's fine. Now I'm getting word from Celeborn and Círdan that there's a bunch of Teleri ships burned on the coast. What conclusion do I come to? Given my frame of mind, right? What conclusion is he got to come to? Marie, I absolutely agree. I think he's got to fear that Olwë is dead, especially if we're recalling the Círdan and Olwë business, right? And he is expecting that Olwë might return. Ships from the west is something that he could be expecting reasonably, especially since Círdan and Olwë had that thing in season 2 where they were like, okay, you know, let's set up the ferry system, right? Let's keep lines of communication open between Valinor and Middle-earth. We want to go to Valinor. We want to be in Middle-earth. We feel called to both of these things. Let us be both sides of this thing. So he thinks that Olwë's probably dead, and as Mariel points out, he's not wrong, right? Except he is wrong. Yeah, Zach, you're right. Zachary Komen is reminding us that the message of the burned ship should include the fact that there weren't any bodies. Well, maybe the one, but maybe they don't find that one. anyway, it's so like basically they're not seeing signs of a battle, so they can. They can say like we there's, you know, the message can be, you know. He can ask, Thingol can say, you know, did you find Olwë? You know, were my people slain there on the beaches? And they can be like, no, we didn't find any evidence of that. It's just the ships were burned. And he can, I guess he can just be kind of confused, right? Again,
so let's see.
So I'm kind of confused and not sure what is going on is not a very, like,
You know, that doesn't make for compelling TV.
Not as a culmination of the season. No, it's fine in the middle, right? But yes, and now we end on a note of just kind of bewilderment, and nobody knows what's happening. Like that doesn't seem.
Yeah. Do we? So, like, what do we want the final note of this season to be? Is it hopeful?
I think.
Is it mixed? Okay, is it ominous?
It's mixed. Final vision is the rising of the sun, right?
Right.
And I think symbolically what we want to do with that is two different things. On the one hand, this is a sign of hope, right? And the enemy will be driven away. So we have a kind of the rising of the sun in the one sense foreshadows, though it's a little odd to talk about the rising of the sun foreshadowing things. But anyway, the rising of the sun foreshadows the war of wrath, right? I mean, this is like, you know, the good guys from the West are coming in to Middle-earth and driving, you know, Melkor and his servants in front of them symbolically, temporarily, right? This is the anticipation of that. So sun as promissory note of the intervention of the Valar is one note of the end of this season. And so that is certainly hope. You have not been abandoned. We are not abandoning Middle-earth, and Morgoth, you are being served warning that we are watching you. But that's the other thing, right? The other thing that the sun does is it shows things up, right? We have the clear, seeing things in a clear light. So here I'm thinking of like Feanor's vision at his death, right? Knowledge that his knowledge that their war was not going to be any good, right? That they couldn't hope to succeed in their war against Morgoth. That, I think, is also a note that we need to hit at the end. Yes, there's hope, but it's not like hope that the war of the Noldor against Morgoth is going to go well, right? If anything, there should be a sort of a clarity that it's not going to go well. They don't all necessarily see that, but I think that I do think that we want to have both things. You know,
well, I kind of think for sort of on-screen dramatic purposes, we kind of want to maybe pick one thing that we really want them to take away, or we want to craft like the initial reaction, which maybe should be
negative. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm thinking the original reaction is positive, and then we go negative after that.
And then we go negative. Yeah.
I mean, the first instinct, like the immediate reaction to the rising of the sun is that like light drives away the darkness. I mean, that's got to be the very first thing. And we've got, you know, orcs scattering and trolls turning to stone. So, I mean, it's going to be a dramatically good thing initially. So I think the kind of the negative has to follow. Or rather, the sort of confronting of sober reality, right?
Right. I do kind of like, at least within the context of Thingol, I do feel like Melian's appropriate role is wet blanket.
Yes. Well, it is a sort of a frequent role.
So I'm kind of inclined to go with a Thingol initially is kind of excited. Well, their ships are on fire, but no one's dead. And
it could still be a good thing.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got it. Like, I like the idea of him saying, like, you know, well, they're here. We should send out some search parties and go find our kin because they're here. They might need our help. The sun's up. Things are great. And Melian sort of, you know, darkly hinting that you're probably not going to find what you're looking for.
Right. I have a more radical suggestion. Let's ditch the messenger entirely. Let's just ditch the messenger.
Yes, I agree, actually.
The point
it
of the
just
messenger,
makes it too complicated.
The point of the messenger originally was to bear news that the Noldor had arrived and to have that news reaching Thingol and Melian at the end and to show them, you know, and sort of Melian's forebodings that, you know, this might not be quite as good as it looks. So that was the original thought there. That was why we were doing a messenger in the first place. I don't know that we want to end the to have the final note of the Thingol and Melian story in this season be bewildered failure to solve a mystery, right? That doesn't seem like a good note to end the season on. So let's ditch it. Let's forget it. If we can't get them tidings of the Noldor, and I don't think we can, based on what we were... I mean, I like the leaving Círdan. You know, we leave Círdan and Celeborn before they make contact with the... Again, we save that. We save the first contact between the Teleri and, you know, between the Sindar and the Noldor until season four as well. But we... then, so I think we can come back to Thingol and Melian, but just have them react to the rising of the sun, right? That'll give them, we have plenty of excuse for a final Thingol and Melian scene after the sun rises, right? Yeah. See, Brianna is having exactly the same problem that I've been having as I've been thinking about this episode. Brianna just said, I keep imagining the rising of the sun as the very last moment, culminating after a building swell of an orchestra, with the final shot being the waking of men. Exactly. So you get the rising of the sun, and then we just show without dialogue all of these scenes, right? We show, you know, Fingolfin, the armies of Morgoth scattering. We show Fingolfin pounding on the doors of Angband. We show, and then at the end, Brianna, as you suggest, we show the awakening of men, right? Exactly the problem I keep having, Brianna, is that we've got all these other things that need wrapping up,
and
right?
And then we finish with a 10-minute scene of Thingol and Melian pouring over the message.
The message of the burned ships, right? Yeah, exactly.
What on earth is this? What do you think?
Yeah, yeah, trying to sleuth their way around that problem.
Sounds exciting.
It does. So I don't think we can do that. And Brianna, in the end, I don't think we can have the sun be the very last thing. We need several things to happen after the sun rises. Like, we need a sequence of events after the sun rises, and I think probably
What do we really need to happen after the sun rises? You sure we can't end with, like, a dramatic, like, one-minute sequence where the sun's rising and we just do a montage of things, of scenes with things happening?
Fingolfin's the problem. Fingolfin is the problem. Everybody else, we could just get a reaction shot, right? Reaction shot from Thingol and Melian. Reaction shot from Maedhros hanging on the cliff. Reaction shot from Morgoth. Reaction shot from Sauron and the armies and the trolls turning to stone. Reaction shot from the Sons of Feanor in their camp saying, what? What? Everybody, we'd be fine with... And then the reaction shot of men waking up. But the Fingolfin is the problem, right? Because he, after the sun rises, needs to charge down, beat on the gates of Angband, and then leave and possibly reforge Ringo. Right? And that kind of all needs to happen after.
Sure, we can't just finish with the sun rising over the army of Fingolfin's army arrayed out in front of the gates of Angband and him beating on the door and just leave it at that.
If we leave it at anything, I would want it to be that, right? And by the way, Fingolfin, except, all right, hang on. I can't have Fingolfin beating on the doors of Angband be without dialogue. He needs to call out Morgoth, right? This needs to be, so that when he comes for their final duel after the Battle of Sudden Flames, which... according to my schedule, comes at the very end, in the very climactic episode of next season, right, of season four. We're going to have, so we end season three and season four with Fingolfin pounding on the gates of Angband and challenging Morgoth to come out. He doesn't come out the first time. He does come out the second time. I'm not trying to stir up the whole that can't all happen in one season story. Again, that's a conversation for another day. My point is, that's a huge, important climactic moment, the duel between Fingolfin and Morgoth, and I want to set it up with the beating on the gates of Angband. I guess here's my other concern about the reason why I feel that Fingolfin's plotline requires a certain amount of movement post-Sunrise. Like, it's not... I have a hard time encapsulating it in a single image. Again, if it were one image, it would be that one of him beating on the doors. But what do we convey with that? I mean, if that's the final image we get of Fingolfin, or indeed perhaps any of the Noldor, is him pounding on the gates of Angband, what message are we leaving our viewers with? What are we, like, as they wait for the beginning of next season, what are we leading them to think? Just that he's besieging it? That he's attacked it? That he's like,
yeah.
What's the outcome?
Yeah, actually, in some ways, that'll set up a really anticlimactic first episode of next season where we end with him banging on the door. Maybe
and
we do we do a pull away shot where we show his, like, you know, huge forces, and they're like, oh, big battle, see you next time. And then start the next episode, he's back at his camp sharpening Ringo, and it's like, wait, what happened?
Right, exactly. Or like, to, you know, we return right to where we left off. There's Fingolfin still pounding on the door. Nobody answers. Nothing happens. So we just turn and walk away. Like, okay. I think that we can make that work here. Like, if we did that sequence here, we can show Morgoth not answering, Morgoth still cowering from the sun, Fingolfin then retreating, because his people are beat up, right? I mean, he's come straight from the Helcaraxa, for crying out loud, right? I mean, his people are a mess. But I think it's the... And again, this is where I come in with the sequence, right? I mean, no matter how gung-ho they are, either to fight Feanor or to fight Morgoth, they need to regroup right after crossing the Helcaraxa. You know, we're all frostbitten, on the verge of starvation. Like, can we get a day or something, you know, right to recoup? Why don't they? Why do they go straight to Angband? Answer: the sun rises, right? And they take the opportunity. So, you know, I could even imagine essentially Fingolfin and the rest of them saying, well, okay, folks, let's, you know, some people are saying, like, Angron wants to go find Feanor right away. Others of you think we should go attack Morgoth first. Let's table this discussion for a little while we recuperate and stuff. And then the sun rises, and everyone's like, okay, no, now is the moment. Look, the enemy is scattering. Let's go. We shall take this as a sign, Mariel. Exactly. We take this as a sign, and then we charge there, but it doesn't work, right? You know, they get there and they can't win. So Nick, that's exactly what I'm thinking. I think that we can have them retreat now and still have it be dignified and not just seem hideously disappointing. I don't think we can do that. If we make people wait anticipating that there's going to be a great battle and that the gates of Angband are going to be broken by Fingolfin, only to have him in the first 5 minutes of episode one just turn and walk away,
is there a way we can reduce those expectations? One suggestion would be, radical suggestion: Fingolfin doesn't do any of that. He doesn't go to the gates and bang on them. I know you're going to reject that out of hand.
But okay.
less radical suggestion. What if we make it crystal clear to the viewers that this is not that he's not going, he's not initiating assault. So maybe, and this could be a foreshadowing of future Fingolfin actions. What if Fingolfin rides alone to the gates?
I was just thinking that.
Bangs on the door, maybe plants a sword in the ground in front of the gate, and then storms off. So it's like, I'm not here to invade. I'm just here to give you, like, you know, to let Morgoth know we're here.
I was just thinking that too, right? What if Fingolfin? Yeah. So first of all, Fingolfin would have to reforge Ringo earlier, right? He'd have to reforge Ringo like in episode 12 after they arrive, like by moonlight or something, probably. But anyway, whatever happens. So I'm thinking his people are in their camp. Like, they're a mess, right? I mean, we've shown the suffering of the host of Fingolfin as they cross the Helcaraxa. They're, you know, like, yeah, they're on solid ground now, and it's not quite so cold, and the moon is up, and the sun's about to rise, but they're still frostbitten and half-starved, right? So I think it would be okay for, like, his first concern is to take care of his people, and then the sun rises, and I think he maybe plan A is to go and charge Morgoth to single combat, right? And he goes and and Morgoth doesn't answer his challenge, right? This also makes his challenge to single combat later on sound less completely insane, basically, right? And more of it, because I like the idea of, I mean, yes, he is Fey when he goes and he challenges Morgoth later on, but I would love to have Fingolfin's end after the Dagor Bragollach be not, committing suicide by Morgoth, right? You know, using Morgoth as an instrument of suicide, but rather, I am going to risk my own life in the last desperate hope. Like, I once challenged Morgoth to single combat. I'm going to do it again. And, you know, and this now, whereas before, you know, he was feeling confident because the sun had just risen and the creatures of Morgoth were cowering. And he can be saying, you know, come out and face me in the light, in the light of the sun, you know, beneath the eyes of the Valar, come and face me here and I will fight you. He now goes in desperation, right? And without real hope that he's going to win, but it's the only chance that he then sees. It becomes the one hope of victory that Fingolfin retains after the Dagor Bragollach, thinking that it's the only possible hope. It's a little radical. And of course it runs the risk of, well, I mean, it runs the risk, of course, of making the, his later challenge less unique. But I think if we set it up properly, it could make it even more powerful.
I like this idea a lot. I think this solves the problem. It doesn't give the audience false expectations about a giant battle.
Yes.
It does a wonderful, like, it really, yeah, it fits perfectly into kind of the later events and builds like a nice narrative where this isn't like, he didn't just lose. Later on, he doesn't just go nuts and go challenge Morgoth, but that, like, this is something he intended to do from day one.
Right.
And that the first time around, Morgoth was too scared to come out, maybe because of the sun. And then later on, you know, Morgoth finally does come out because, you know, it's too shameful not to. Right. And I think then now we have a way to kind of, like, we can fiddle with the timing of how this is handled at the end to get the ending we want. Like, we could have him running up to the gate in the bright of day, or we could have him do it and have the sun rise while he's like marching, like while he's walking dramatically away from the gate, with his banner planted in the ground in front of the gate. Or he could already be back at his camp sharpening Ringo when the sun rises. Like, I think this gives us a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, I agree. So I agree. Now, Zach asks the question, why doesn't Morgoth answer this first challenge? Several reasons for that, which I think suggest themselves fairly quickly. One, first of all, remember, he does not answer the second challenge gladly. Right, he's I won't say nervous, but he is not eager to come out and fight Fingolfin even the second time. Right, the first time, under the full light of the new sun, with Arian looking down on him. Right, and remember, what's he thinking? Morgoth has got to be thinking, this is it. Right, this is it. They're coming. The Valar are coming. He does not want to, it's not that he's necessarily, it's not like he's afraid of Fingolfin necessarily, though again, he wouldn't face Fingolfin eagerly, and doesn't either time, but he's got to think, like, if I step out of these gates, like, Tolkas is coming over that hill, right? Any minute now, like, the sun, that's got to be the conclusion he comes to when the sun comes up. I think, I think that that's enough, really, to say or to explain why he wouldn't come why he wouldn't come out. And he's got, and it's got to burn him, right? I mean, he's got to be losing face in there. As Fingolfin is shouting his defiance and his challenge, and Morgoth is not coming, that's got to be embarrassing. And that's one of the reasons why he does come the second time. Even though, you know, he could easily just have Fingolfin taken and tortured or whatever when Fingolfin is there all by himself in front of the gates the second time, right? So why does he not do that? Why does he not just faithlessly capture Fingolfin and torture him to death? Reason, because he's still burning from this one, right? He feels the need to redeem himself for not fighting Fingolfin the first time. And I think that works pretty well. So, Nick, I have to disagree with you that this is far less climactic than the book's description. The army coming up, pounding on the gates, and then turning around and walking away, I think is not far more climactic than this challenging to single combat and defying Morgoth like this. So I flatly disagree with you that the book's description there is far more climactic. But the other thing, the question, Nick, that you were asking before that, why is it important that we don't play out the scene as written just because we want a sunrise montage in the final moments of the episode? Yeah, the question is, how do we end the season, right? And we don't have a culminating thing. We don't. I mean, we have the rising of the sun. That's it. That's the only thing we have at the end of this season is the rising of the sun. And so it therefore seems that if we're going to make the ending of this season powerful, then we need to... It's Buddha!
So much for my being quiet.
Trish is back.
And I can't talk very well because half my mouth is novocained. But
right.
Anyway,
we hear the herald of Trish,
Budanwe.
Exactly.
Oh hush! He was getting pissed because the cat Megovanen was bothering him. And that was why he was yelling. But I do have a question. I was going to say, so I think we did this once before. So this is deja vu, probably for you guys. Don't we have Maedhros on the side of the mountain at the end of this?
Yeah, he's there. He's there. Yeah, we discussed the mechanics of stapling him to the cliff earlier in the episode. Yeah.
Right. I've been reading. Dave's been taking copious notes on Twitter, so I studied up before but he got so excited about the Fingolfin going by himself to the gates that he forgot to tweet. So he didn't put any of that on Twitter,
okay.
And I was like, oh my god. But
oh, yeah, I'm posting it right now.
Oh, okay.
I usually lag.
So I mean, as far as drama is concerned, I mean, maybe it's a visual and auditory drama, not a parrot, but
yes.
Like, you know,
speaking
we
of auditory
fade
drama.
Out.
Yeah.
Right. We fade out on Maedhros on the wall and we hear an eagle cry in
yeah.
the background.
No,
you know what I mean? It's like something like that as opposed to it being like a plot drama. You know what I mean?
No, I really like this. I mean, to me, this seems like a really compelling way to end both the episode and the season, right? With this kind of really striking visual because the number one effect, right? The most immediate effect of the rising of the sun is the visual effect, right? The striking visuals of the rising of the sun on all of these things. And so to be going around and to be emphasizing the visuals with music, with maybe a line or two, but very, very few lines, right? Mostly kind of images and all of this stuff. But Nick, in answer to your question, why would he not have Fingolfin captured this time if he's walking up alone? Nobody dares to come out. Like, the trolls are turning into stone. The orcs are terrified. No servant of Morgoth is going to dare show his nose outside the gates. The creatures, like the orcs and trolls and werewolves and stuff, because they can't or won't in the sun, Morgoth himself or Sauron or Gothmog or any of them, for the same reason that Morgoth doesn't, because they're afraid that Tulkas and Oromer are coming over the hill.
I personally think I would say Morgoth doesn't even know who it is until he bangs on the door and shouts that he's Fingolfin, son of Finwë, right? Because because it's not like he's got his scouts up on the walls looking down. They're cowering from the sun. So all Morgoth knows is the sun's come up. His various servants and servitors or forces are scattering or hiding or turning to stone or whatever. And then he's sitting in his on his throne, waiting for the Valar to show up. Right? He's like, oh boy, here they come. And then there's banging on the door. And then he's like, what is that? Oh, my God, that's them. They're here.
They're here.
And then he finds out, like, no, it's actually Fingolf.
Right. And he still doesn't want to come. And here's the thing. Yeah. We could do this very efficiently, right? If the whole force is there, if Fingolfin's whole army is there, like in the book, again, we are building up the visual anticipation of a battle. Like, we were showing the whole army there in front of the gate. We would have to actually show them turning around and walking away in order to make the message clear that the battle's not happening.
And that's the real problem. The real problem here is if you have Fingolfin and even a small group go bang on the door, plant a flag, walk away, it looks cool. If you have a whole army show up, bang on the door, turn around, it looks like a retreat.
It looks like a retreat. Exactly.
There's no way it looks good.
Yeah. Whereas, yes, I agree. Fingolfin, like, delivering a challenge, which is not – and then he walks away, like – essentially he hasn't won, right? But he hasn't lost, right? He walks away sort of triumphantly, right? But here's the other thing. The other thing is that we don't even have to show, if it's just him, we don't have to show him walking away. All we have to convey is that Morgoth is not going to accept his challenge. Right? We show the orcs and trolls are scattered, right? So they're a total non-factor. All we would need is one scene, Fingolfin delivering his challenge, and then one shot of Morgoth in there. Like, I'm imagining, like, Morgoth and Gothmog and Sauron sitting inside together, kind of looking at each other, right? And, like, them seeing if he's going to come out, like, you know, essentially to have this, like, nonverbal, are you going to go out? Are you going to send us out? And, like, nobody says anything or does anything, and they just sit there, and it's clear they're not going, right? They're not going to answer the challenge. Even if we don't show him physically turning around and walking away, Fingolfin, we can establish the fact that he's delivered this challenge and it's not going to be taken up. So that if, in the beginning of season four, we come back and the first time we see Fingolfin is he's back, you know, in the camp with his people where he left them, we're not leaving it in suspense. What happened, right? We've shown what happened. What happened is he delivered his challenge and it wasn't taken up. And so, you know, so that's easy enough to sort of show after the fact.
I honestly, I'm quite enamored of my mental image of him dramatically walking away.
Yes.
With like having planted like his standard in the ground.
Ooh,
right in front of the gate.
Yes, the same standard which is later going to be trodden into the mud and the blood on the field of the Nirnaeth Arnoediad. Right?
Yep.
Should get planted in that same field by Fingolfin in defiance at the beginning. Love that. So how about this? Since the primary action sequence at the rising of the sun is Fingolfin, right? Like I said, everybody else is static, right? We can get a static reaction from Thingol and Melian. We get a course of static reaction from Mythros, is what's he going to do? We can get a static reaction from the Fëanorians in their camp. We can get a static reaction from Círdan and Celeborn, right? Perhaps as the sun rises and they see the Noldor camped in the valley below them, right? They're up on the hills looking up from the south and on the mountains looking down into Hithlum. Into Mithrim there. So anyway, there's all kinds of static reaction shots that we can give. We could show Treebeard. We can show Tom Bombadil. Whoever we want to show, right? We can show having... And of course, the orcs are panicking and we're showing the trolls turning to stone. And we can show, you know, the vampires of Thorin Gwethil, you know, flying into caves. All kinds of things that we can intersperse, but among all those things, we have several scenes that only one thread among all of these sequences, among all of these reaction shots to the rising of the sun, we keep returning to one, and we're moving action forward only in one place, and that's Fingolfin, right? So the sun rises. Maybe Fingolfin goes alone to look at Angband, like to look over Angband, right? And the sun rises then. So we see the sun rising as Fingolfin is looking towards the gates, right? And then we get other reaction shots. And we cut back to Fingolfin, and he's standing before the gates. And we show Fingolfin pounding on the gates and shouting his challenge, right? And then we have other reaction shots. And we show the reaction shot of Morgoth and the others looking at each other, you know, saying, I'm not it, right? And responding to Fingolfin. And then we have other action shots, right? And, you know, other reaction shots, rather. And then we go back to, and then we show, Dave, your shot of Fingolfin planting the standard and striding away like an action hero, right? Walking off, not into the sunset, but into the sunrise, right? And then we can have some other shot, and then we end, of course, the final shot of the season is the awakening of the awakening of the men.
Ooh, and you saying that about action hero merchandising, bobbleheads.
Bobbleheads. Exactly.
Lego,
yeah.
Lego kits. Yeah, you bet.
Yes. Fingolfin at the gates, Lego kit. Absolutely.
That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, I kind of like this idea, like that you just described, in which Brian posted of like, you know, maybe he shows up initially just to check things out. Maybe he sees the gates. Maybe he sees Melkor has some forces stationed outside, has some scouts up on the wall. If we want to throw Nick a bone, maybe we even have Melkor standing up there,
right?
And their eyes meet. Then the sun rises, and all of Melkor's forces retreat. And then that's when Fingolfin gets a little heady and he runs down to the gate and plants his stand, bangs on the door, plants his standard. Yes. I don't have a problem with that. I'm mostly emotionally invested in now is the awesome action shot ending.
Yeah, no, I
don't really
it.
Care how it gets there.
I love it. I think that's the planting of the standard, I think, is really good. And I think works really, really well. Let's see.
Maybe we can add a breeze from the ocean.
Yeah. Hey, why not? Why not? Brianna, we are going to have, wait, do we want the sun to rise in the east or the west? I know that seems like a question one doesn't normally ask, but of course, in this case, it's an issue. If it rises in the west the first time and then later on, like come season four, it's rising in the east like normal, we might need to explain that. And I was speaking fairly strongly against making astronomical explanations of things last time. So, but symbolically, Phil, I kind of agree. Like the sun rising out of the west kind of seems like what we need here, doesn't it? Yeah, I don't know how we can avoid it for the sake of these scenes. We want the light to be coming from the west. We want them to be looking towards the west at the rising sun, thinking that this is, this is possibly like maybe the light comes from the Valar themselves as they approach. Right? I mean, it could be that kind of thing. Yeah, Zach, I think we just have it rise in the west this once and we just don't explain it, you know. The Valar have sorted out the rising of the sun and they've started it rising in the east between season 3 and season 4 and we're just never going to explain that. I'm actually okay with that. But I kind of think we have to have it rise in the west. Yeah, Zach says, just leave it an Easter egg for the book fans, right? Yeah, exactly, Zach. We'll make it rise in the west once, and then it'll rise in the east after that, just so as to give real Tolkien diehards an excuse to look really smart to all their friends and lecture them at tedious length about the astronomy of Middle-earth. That makes good sense, actually. Yeah, good, okay. I like it. Okay. Good. So that happened kind of unexpectedly on this. I'm looking back at the slide and I'm like, wait, why did I have this slide up? Okay, we kind of got distracted. But I think we solved the end of the the end of the episode issue. I think that that really works. Again, the only trick is we do need to make sure that we reforge Ringo sooner, right? Because he should have Ringo. I guess it doesn't really matter if he has Ringo or not.
Yeah, I don't think it matters.
I don't think it matters. Maybe we can skip it. Hey, I know. Let's just put that in season 4 because we barely have anything to do in season 4 anyway. So, like, we need to fill some dead space in season 4. So.
We're worried we're not going to be able to even fill out a whole season.
Yeah, that's my concern. So we'll just push that forward. That'll be good. The Hiding of Valinor. Now, The Hiding of Valinor. When do we time that? We wanted the actual hiding, so the decision to hide Valinor, we were talking about that. We had the Valar discussing this issue back in the Making of the Sun and Moon episode, right? So that's fine. We know it's going to happen, but we were going to wait to actually have it occur, to have that be one of the final notes of Season 3 here, the Hiding of Valinor. But when do we want it to happen in the sequence? We could have it... We could do it in the final montage. We could include the images of the mountains of the Pelori rising and, you know, the arising in the sea of the Magic Isles, right? We could have that happen as part of the montage. Yeah. Yeah, that's what Nick was just voting for, too. Yeah, I think the less dialogue, the better, frankly, in the Hiding of Valinor. We might want to get, therefore, a couple reaction shots from the Valar, right? As they're looking to remind, you know, so that when we show the mountains rising, we need to make sure we have very plain visual cues like, hey, don't forget, this is happening in Valinor. This is not happening some random place in Middle Earth. Don't get confused. You know, we need to return to a shot of maybe Varda and Manwë looking out from Tenequitil, and then we sort of like pan out from there and show the mountains, you know, show Aule raising the mountains, right? We can have Aase. You know, calling up the islands from the sea. Not Olmo, because he's not really cool with this plan, right? But Aase will go along with it. Yeah, Nick, I think we need to show the sun rising behind Tenequitil, right? So, we, you know, at sunrise, we need a shot of Varda and Manwë there. Actually, I can imagine a really awesome visual, right, where we're looking at them and Varda is glowing, right? You know, Varda is shining with light, and then she shines brighter and brighter, and then the sun rises. So, like, the light from Varda and the light of the sun as, like, the rim of the sun rises up above the horizon for the first time up behind the mountain kind of combine and you know, make this overwhelming light, and that's the first of the sunrise scenes, right? So that we're recalling that this is, in fact, from the Valar. Yeah, 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 Nick, exactly. Nick says we could have Melkor standing on Thangorodrim and Manwë can see him from there, right? So we could actually start this with like a standoff. Remember, Morgoth is all triumphant, right? Morgoth has just finished, essentially, right? Just finished his gloating speech over the semi-conscious body of Maedhros, right? He's standing there on that ledge looking out into the west, towards the west, right, saying about how he's won and how, you know, he's awesome and he's the master of doom and everything, and then the sun rises, right? Then we cut from him looking out to the west to Manwë and Varda standing on Tenequitil looking out eastwards towards him, and then the sun rises behind him. Yeah, that works really, really well. Love that. Love that. And Brian, absolutely we can get a reaction shot of Finarfin and the other returned Noldor. Looking at the Pelori and the rising sun and turning their back on Middle-earth. Love that, Brian. Great idea. Great idea. I mean, I am okay for the rising of the sun sequence to take, like, 5 minutes. Like, it can take a while. And I think it could be really, really striking to have all these different visual scenes and the sun breaking over them and the response of people, even a word or two. It's okay, I think, to have a little bit of dialogue. It doesn't have to all be silent. We could break it up but not much, not conversation, right? Just like a single line from a single character or whatever. Oh no, this is good. I am glad we have found a way to make the rising of the sun into a suitably dramatic moment here at the end of the season, and to be also a thing which is in that way going to kind of tie everything together, right? Because we'll have the Valar, we'll have the Valinor stuff, we'll have all the different Noldor factions, we'll have Thingol and Melian. We'll have Círdan and Celeborn looking down, and Celeborn being all like, looking over the camp where his wife is, his future wife, and that's great. Absolutely. I think that works really well. Okay, let me go back to my slides then, because there are other things we probably have not talked about now that we've worked this all out. Actually, let me finish this slide. Cyrus and the guest elves welcome to Doriath. Yeah, I don't think we need a scene for that. We could show them there. I think we don't need much action at all in Doriath, especially if we're not going to have a messenger come back, which I'm now fairly firmly anti-messenger. I kind of like the idea of cutting that out entirely, so that all we get from Círdan, or not from Círdan, all we get from Thingol and Melian is their reaction to the sunrise, right? So we can have Cyros there, right, so that we're reminded of Cyros's presence, so Cyros can be kind of standing there behind, with Mablung and Beleg behind Círdan, right? Let's have like a little Doriath tableau, right, with Thingol and Melian and Luthien and Dairon tastefully arranged, and then like Mablung and Beleg and Cyros, right? They can all be there. That could be good. And good. Okay, so Boldog and the remnants of his army return to Angband. Oh, man. What if Boldog and the rest of his army are returning to Angband right when the sun rises? So, like, they go, they're like, coming up, and then they end up getting scattered and go running in through the gates or whatever. I think actually having Boldog and his army to show them being scattered by the sun, just show them running for cover when the sun rises, would be kind of cool, because it's a good reminder that Boldog exists, right? His last battle was several episodes ago now. And he's like the representative orc, right? He's the spokesperson for the orcs. So to show his reaction to the sun would be a really good way to sort of encapsulate the orcish reaction to the sun in general. Tevildo's cats. I don't know that we need Tevildo in this episode. I think we could do without the cats or the werewolves. We want orcs and we definitely want trolls. But I don't know that we necessarily need Tevildo or Drugluin or maybe Thorin Gwethil. Again, I just kind of like the visual image of, the bats, the giant bats flying, shrieking for cover. Okay. Yeah. We could work in a scene with Gothmog and Sauron in Angband, right? Sauron has done pretty well for himself, right? I mean, okay, like the whole Girdle of Melian thing was kind of, I didn't pan out in the end exactly as he'd planned. His armies have been kind of defeated in the south, but he has much more to show for his work than Gothmog does, right? So I guess at the end of the day, their competition is like who failed less, and Sauron is totally failed less than Gothmog did. So I guess that's, well, I guess, but then Gothmog can say that they killed Feanor, so I guess maybe it's a tie. I'm not sure if we want to include an explicit scene with them or not. I guess I would kind of incline against not, but you know what I'm having a hard time with now, Dave? And Trish too, because I keep forgetting Trish is here now.
Now what?
Now that
yeah, we're just because Putin's not making noise anymore. Fine, right. Just forget about me.
now that we've worked in all of this awesome stuff into that final sequence, now I'm like, so wait, so what happens in the rest of the episode? If we do that in the last 5 minutes, what do we do in the first 45? Right?
Well, part of this, I mean,
the writers will figure that out.
I think we're already there, but I mean, you know, my thought, I mean, we're going to pretty much end on kind of almost like a hopeless note.
Well, no, it's hopeful too, right? It goes both ways. Like the remember that, like, we get that Fingolfin triumphant, right? And Morgoth not daring to stand up to him. So it looks like, I mean, hope for the good guys. There's definitely hope, but there's also, you know, it's a little grim, no question.
Well, it seems like this episode would be a lot of, like, battle action and conversation about battle action.
I think mostly conversation, though, because we've got Mithros. We've got Mithros and Mithros' interrogation, and then Mithros is stapling to the cliff. We've got that happening. We've got got the Feanorians, right? We need the Feanorians to have their conversation.
Right.
Trish, did you hear about the Sauron casting the role of the Mouth of Sauron? Right, he comes up as the Mouth of Melkor, showing tokens of how Mithros has been captive and giving conditions for the release of the captive. Right, this is one of my favorite things.
This is how we figure out that he got the idea to have a Mouth of Sauron.
Exactly. He's recapitulating that with Frodo later on. It's awesome. Anyway, so we've got that, and then the Feanorians deciding that they're not going to do that. Right, and talking about the Curse of Feanor and how they're kind of doomed and feeling different ways about that. We do have all that stuff to do earlier in the episode.
I think you've got a lot there. I mean, you know, and plus you also have the other side. I mean, you could be showing some interactions going on, you know, on the Angband side of life.
Yeah, we could show some of what's going on with the bad guys. We could even, it would be interesting maybe to suggest that they're about to launch an offensive. Right, that like they're like, okay, let's just get together and let's combine all of our forces and let's just smash them. They're all here, right? Let's just smash them where they're standing, and then the sun rises, right, and scatters them. So maybe we could get some Angband discussion in there. Do we need a final Círdan scene? We left Círdan and Celeborn last time. And I didn't want him to make contact, and I still don't want him to make contact. Do we need to? I think we just include him in a reaction shot to the sun rising. I don't think we need any action from them or dialogue from them this episode necessarily.
No, probably not.
Still seeing the elves, still not making contact yet. We'll sort that out next season. Good, good. Okay, let's get ABI. I don't think
unless you think there would be some reason why people wouldn't remember him at the beginning of the next season, but
we'll just show him visually there at the end. It'll be fun.
Yeah, there you go. And we got
staring
up
at the sun. We can't figure anything else out. We'll just do a montage of people looking at the sun.
Exactly. Can't go wrong with a montage of people looking at the sun. Who doesn't love a good montage of people looking at the sun?
And they can have that same facial expression that Legolas had after Gandalf went into the chasm in Moria. Remember that look on his face?
No. No, we cannot do that at all. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Should we show... You know, like one of them figuring out that you should not stare directly at the sun?
I was thinking, if we have a really long montage of people staring at the sun, we do need to have a public service warning, don't we? Okay.
Only elves can do this. Only elves can, you know, elves could probably do it. Men probably couldn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the final image, and we've just resolved that. We're pretty good. Yeah, the Awakening of the Second Children, we definitely need to have that as the last image. Philip is, you know, talking about, you know, saying this is a really crucial image, and I agree. We do want to make that really clear that they're awakening here, and I agree it can be kind of confusing when men just show up out of nowhere, right, if we don't show this. So, yep. I totally agree. We should do that. Reforging of Ringo. Like I said, I can kind of take it or leave it. I guess I'll leave that. I'll see what the script people think. If you guys think it can be worked in earlier on, either at the early part of this episode, I'd be fine with that. You know, if we wanted to do a, cause we do. Oh yeah. That's the other scene that we need earlier in this episode, right? Is the scene, the discussion among the followers of Fingolfin about what they're going to do. And Angrod saying, let's go hunt Feanor down and kill him. And Turgon doing his thing, right, and foreseeing something, and Yeah. So I will leave the reforging of Ringle to your discretion. If you guys think we just want to shove it into season four, that would be totally fine.
Yeah. Kick the can.
Yeah, I think we can. It'll be plenty of room in season four for everything that we need. And the other things we're including, Mythos, hanging on the cliff will definitely be there in the sun scenes. And then the final scene is Men Awakening. So Men Awakening, let's talk about that very briefly. What do we want that to look like? Where are they? What are they doing? What do they look like? How are they dressed? Are they dressed? Do we have a bunch of naked folks waking up? How many folks do we have waking up? Do we just show, I mean, it's easy enough to say the awakening of the second children, but we can't just say that, right? We got to figure out what we're showing.
Well, one thing for sure, no fig leaves, please.
No fig leaves, yeah. Tastefully positioned bushes. And low-hanging
yeah,
boughs.
The kind of thing that television shows do with their, like, showing nudists in a nudist camp, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, Tony, that's exactly the question. The question is, how Garden of Eden do we want to get with it, right? Because, I mean, there are serious Garden of Eden undertones, right, especially in the Awakening of the Men stuff that Tolkien wrote around the, you know, with, like, the Athrabeth stuff in Morgoth's Ring. So, yeah. Now, it's not Eden. Right. I mean, it's not Eden in the sense of I don't think they're awakening in like a land without suffering or, you know, it's like they're not in paradise when they wake. I mean, it can be a real nice place, right? It's okay for them to be in a good spot and for everything to look lush and beautiful and wonderful. Here's the trick, Tony. The trick with the awakening of the elves, or rather with paralleling the awakening of the humans with the awakening of the elves, is that the elves are already established when they get discovered, right? If I remember correctly, we didn't show the elves waking up. We showed the elves being discovered by Orome an indeterminate period of time after they had woken up. So that's easier. Right. Because they've already built the culture. They've already like invented weaving by the time that they're discovered.
They're clothed
and have built homes and stuff. So, you know, Cui Vienin is, you know, we had it was fairly primitive cultures, but still.
Is it necessary to show men waking up? Is there a reason why we can't just do a shot of a village of men?
Well, that's the problem, is that the waking of, like, this is a moment.
They wake up with the sun, don't
they? Wake up with the sun, yeah. This is a moment. Like, it's the only guide that we have. We do have a guide. Remember, okay, and this is asking a lot. Remember Gilfanan's tale in the Book of Lost Tales, Part 1. The very first version of the Awakening of Humans that Tolkien ever wrote in... an unfinished and sketchy tale, even by Book of Lost Tales standards. He never finished writing this, and it's all choppy and everything, but the way that he conceived this originally, in that very first time, there were a large number of humans, and they were asleep. They were there. It's not like they were created. Like, they're literally asleep, and when the sun awakes, when the sun comes, they literally wake up from sleep. And of course, in the original story in Gilfanan's tale, one of the elves finds them, like finds the valley where the men are still sleeping and wakes up a couple of them. And of course, because it's Tolkien, right? He teaches them language. And so we get this whole like philological sidebar on like the language that he teaches them and how the language of the rest of the men when they awake is derived from that and related to it and everything. Because, you know, like you do when you're Tolkien, but yeah, so we could do it like that. It doesn't have to be Adam and Eve, right? We don't have to have a couple. It can be a group of people asleep and waking up. That is how Tolkien described it in the one time he physically described that scene. I think they'd have to be naked, sleeping. And I agree, a couple people, both Marielle and Tony, are saying this, we do have a thorny issue of race. What do they look like? Are they, I mean, are they a bunch of white folks waking up? Do we have different, like, people with different skin colors waking up? If there's a bunch of them, I wouldn't have any problem with that, actually. You know, we have, like, a mixture of different peoples. They're going to sort themselves out into different peoples and clans fairly quickly, right? I wouldn't have a hard time. I would not object to having an uncertain number of people rising from sleep or sitting up out of sleep, right? Blinking in the new sunlight, and to have them, you know, to have people of you know, various racial appearance. That would seem fine. Yeah, Tony, I think we want to avoid any snakes in the shot at all.
I agree.
Yeah,
I
no
agree.
Snakes.
We do want to. You're right. We do want to have diversity. We don't want this to be all like any one single morphology or color of people, right?
It kind of seems like it has to be that way, because we're not going to have time. I mean, see, here's where we get back to. We don't want to be answering hardcore scientific questions because Tolkien's mythology is not built on the answers to hardcore scientific questions.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, like one could say, well, the progenitors of the human race all resembled one another, but then over time, and as they distributed themselves geographically, you know, through an evolutionary process, they came to look dissimilar from one another. That's not possible. There's no time for that.
Right.
You know, we need to have the different groups of people looking different. You know, we need to have essentially different sort of ethnic stocks of humanity in far too short a time for that to have happened by a natural evolutionary process. Yeah. So no, I think a multiracial group of humans at Hildorian. Yeah, I think that's kind of the way we have to go. Because from there, the whole point is that from there, they're going to spread out, right, in various different directions. But there's going to be the biggest single chunk of them, which is going to head west towards the light, right? Bank this idea. I had an idea. This is a brilliant idea. It's for season 4, but it's a brilliant idea. So the explanation about the sunrise. So we got the sun rising in the west, and then it's rising in the east later on. We have a human myth about that, right? The humans can tell a mythical story about this, that the sun rises in the west, right? So when they first awoke, they're looking off to the light in the west, right? But then the sun reverses its course, and they take this as a sign that they're supposed to follow the sun to the west, right? The sun is now leading them towards the source of the light. The sun first arose in the west, and now it's leading them into the west. So they interpret this mythically, right? To explain why they should go into the west to seek the light, right?
Oh, very good.
Boom. Yeah, we got it. No need for astronomy. Thank you very much when we have myth. So that works very well.
Yeah, I like it.
okay. Excellent. So that's Nick, that'll fit into season 4 just like everything else will fit into season 4. It's gonna be awesome.
Season 4, our only season of Beleriand and its realms.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be fine. It'll be fine.
One thought about the men waking up. Tell me if you think this would be hokey. What if we did it kind of like from a first person point of view? So we have. Bear with me. Okay. We have like the dramatic. We have sort of the dramatic montage of established characters reacting to the sun with music. And then there's kind of a fade to black and the music goes out. And then we get like eyeballs opening, so like, you know, the screen comes right back on, and we get like a first person experience of sitting up and then standing up and looking around and seeing the other men.
That's interesting. With no music, right? So we have this, like, we've had this swirling music through the montage, and then it cuts, and all we're getting is, like, the sound, like, the gentle tweeting of birds and the rustle of bushes and stuff in the background as we're getting that.
Yep.
That,
yep.
The first impressions
you want this
of
the
new world.
I think it would give you sort of, like, the experience of well, first of all, I think we want this, like, there's no, like, quite frankly, if we're imagining that the audience consists largely of people who haven't been reading the Silmarillion their entire lives, there's no point in trying to make the waking up of men dramatic, because people aren't going to get it.
Right.
Because if you don't know what's to come, you don't understand why you should care about this. So I think it's more interesting if you make it mysterious.
Right.
Like, oh, what's going on? Like, make it feel like sort of an unexpected scene. The scene, you know, things, we have the dramatic montage, season finale, blah, blah, blah. Okay, we're done. Go to black. And then we get this surprise, like, oh, whoa, what's going on? Men are waking up.
And it's funny, Dave, I thought the sentence that you were starting to say earlier, you're saying, you know, if we assume that the audience is composed mostly of, what I thought you were going to say, how I thought you were going to finish that sentence was, if our audience is composed mostly of human beings, then...
that too.
Having showing that from the first person, we're conveying the message in kind of a subtle way that this is us. Right, this is us awakening.
Yeah.
This is humanity. We, as the human audience, the modern human audience watching these stories to this point, we've just been the spectators of these historical events, right? This is us coming on the scene for the first time. So it can work
honestly
that way.
I'm not, and then, like, when I think about sort of alternatives, I honestly not sure how else to do it that doesn't seem weird. Like, you know, it's like kind of camera angle pointed down at some people and they just kind of appear on screen, or...
Well, the way I was originally picturing it is close-up of a sleeping person's face, and then we see them, like, or, like, the person blinking in the new sunlight and kind of looking around. As you say, not like a big shot of, like, all of the tactfully covered naked people from a, like, a helicopter shot, but rather just, like, so we choose one person.
That works too.
I was picturing a woman, a female face, and then we show her blinking in the sunlight and looking around, and then we kind of pan outwards and we see other people sitting up and stuff.
Right. That would work too. If people don't like the first person thing, because as Brianna points out, it feels a little bit like a video game. Maybe. I think this could work too, especially if you kind of started like. Like, let's say, I'm not quite sure how to do it, but like something to where you can't see this person right away, but maybe you kind of hear sleep-like breathing,
right?
And then like the sun, and then the sun arises. Maybe the sun crests a hill or a mountain, and it's, you know, slowly their face gets lit, right. And then they kind of like. Probably they don't jerk awake, but maybe they yawn and
a slow, graceful awakening, definitely. Blinking in the new light, right? You know, to show like the adjustment to the light, but looking around and smiling and seeing, you know, the beauty of the world around them, and then we cut. I kind of like the first person idea. I think that's cool. I mean, we have to see. That would be one of those things, like we've said before, and indeed, even Brianna, as you have chided us before, like let's give the videographers a shot at this, right? If they can do this in a non-hokey way, cool. If not, then we'll do it in a more conventional way. But
I'm fine with that. I think that the main thing that I'm sort of proposing here that I'm interested in is the idea that we don't try to make the final the dramatic montage swell into the awakening of men, but rather we let it die down, and then we do like a very subtle no music or anything scene of a person waking up and looking around, and so that it feels a lot like it feels definitely like this, you know, an interesting mystery and the start of something as opposed to like a dramatic moment.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And then, you know, the production people, you
Breaking up again there, Dave.
Oh, I said production people, you figured it out.
Exactly. Yeah, you guys figured it out. Exactly. No, I like that. That's good. Okay, excellent. I think we're in good shape there, and we're almost out of time. So let me just then end by saying, so for next time, remember, we're going to do script outlines next time, as many as we can get through, which I suspect is going to be somewhere between four and six. Yes, so next week, we are going to meet next week. So this week, we had to push forward because I couldn't meet last week, because I was in Boston last week. So this week, this is last week's session now. So we're going to go back to our original schedule for Friday the 20th will be our next session, where we'll be talking about the script outlines. And as I walked you through on the forums before, forums.signumuniversity.org to Some Film Project script, season three script outlines. You can see there are the links there for the first like six, I think, of the script outlines. And I cannot imagine that we will get past six, next time. But definitely review the script outlines for episodes 1 through 4. That's what we're going to be discussing next time. Maybe we'll get further than that, but definitely at least 1 through 4. So that's the plan. As I recall, we got through like 3 or 4 per episode last year when we did this. But we'll see. All right. Very good. So that's our instructions for next time. Thanks for joining us. I feel really happy with where we got with this. I was not sure at the beginning of the episode. You know, I have to admit, I was a little skeptical coming in. I'm like, I don't know how we're going to pull this off. The ending of this season seems a little bit, seems lame. The more I look at it, the lamer it seems. But I think we've done a good job in figuring this out.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Exactly. No, I never doubted that we'd sort it out eventually. Very good. Okay, thanks everybody for joining us, and we will see you guys again next week. And say in the meantime, thank you for listening, and Godspeed.